want to welcome you to this joint hearing in the House Environment and Natural Resources Finance Division and the Senate Environment, Energy and Natural Resources Budget Division. We are going to be doing a joint hearing and appreciate all the folks who have agreed to help us out learning about some of the emerging issues and emerging solutions, because we are into problem solving. That is our job as legislators. And we see a huge demand for dollars in the hundreds of millions of dollars continuing year after year after year for sewage systems. And, of course, local communities asking the state to participate. Because of that, and because of some bonding tours where we have been asked about sewage again and again, the bonding committee in the House, and I know the Senate has had the same issues, asked us if we would talk about and have the community talk to us about emerging science, what it is teaching us about directions that we should be taking in dealing with sewage issues. We're also then going to talk about finance, but first we'll talk about the science first. Senator Anderson is on her way, has been delayed, and so I thought it was important that we get started. And with that, we would like to welcome Daniel Wheeler, Sarah Christofferson, and if you would introduce yourself for the tape and tell us your titles.
Okay. My name is Dan Wheeler. I'm a research fellow at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Soil, Water, and Climate and the Water Resources Center.
And I'm Sarah Christofferson. I'm an engineer in the Water Resource Department at the University of Minnesota, and I work in the on-site sewage treatment program.
Mm-hmm. Would you all prefer to take questions? Members always have questions. Would you prefer to take them as you go or at the end?
It would be fine if when the questions arise that they go ahead and interrupt my polished presentation.
Thank you for that. All right, if you would begin.
Well, thank you, Chairperson Wagenius and members of the committees. I would like to just thank you for giving us the opportunity today to speak to you about some of Minnesota's small communities and their wastewater needs. Like we mentioned, we are from the University of Minnesota and represent the on-site sewage treatment program, which we'll get into in a few minutes about what exactly that is. Before we go there, I wanted to give you a situation of a small town in Minnesota that is quite typical, and the town is called Nickelville, Minnesota. I don't know if any of the members of either committee have ever been to or heard of Nickelville. Anyone want to guess where it might be?
Dime City?
No. It's outside of Austin, Minnesota in Maurer County. Okay, so about 5 miles to the east of Austin, Minnesota. It's quite a nice place. If you haven't been there, I would recommend that you go visit there. It's a nice rural community, much like many of our rural communities across the state. Some of the characteristics of this town, 16 homes, which isn't a whole lot, about 35 people live in the community and one business. It's a nice bedroom community, a nice place to maybe retire, a nice place to maybe start a family outside of the hustle and bustle of the big city of Austin. It's typical of many of our rural areas, surrounded by agricultural land, so throughout the seasons the scenery changes quite a bit and can be quite a nice place to be. There's a creek on the edge of town that provides all kinds of opportunities for recreation and scenic beauty as well. Quiet community and great neighbors. Sounds like a great place to live. I don't know if I've convinced you to move there with me yet, but it's a good place. But there's a little problem in Nickelville, as it turns out, that Nickelville has improper wastewater treatment facilities. It basically has one collection system or a septic tank that directly discharges partially treated wastewater into this nice little creek. The creek's name is Dobbins Creek and has been identified as having a fecal coliform impairment. Those of you that are probably aware that fecal coliform is something that can be traced back to human intestines or maybe some livestock. So there's contamination of this waterway due to fecal coliform. And part of the explanation might be the lack of wastewater treatment or proper wastewater treatment in the town of Nickelville. So how can this happen? This seems like a fairly obvious thing to fix. Some of the things that I've attributed to this problem are small lots in town, that there's really no effective way to treat wastewater on these individual sites. It might have poor soil conditions, wet soils, things that allow or prevent the proper treatment of their wastewater. Some of it's just purely economics, that it costs a lot to improve these wastewater systems to current standards. Maybe it's been that in the past the alternatives that have been presented are poorly suited to the community. Maybe they change the character of the community. They might allow development that may or may not be desired by the community, things like that. And there's some apathy in the community as well, that if we don't need to change, we're not going to change. So all of these things play out in Nickelville. Well, Nickelville is not alone as we look across Minnesota, and I apologize, some of this, the map isn't very clear here, but what this map is a preliminary report from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency about small communities in Minnesota with wastewater needs. The numbers on the map actually show you the number of small communities per county. So as you scan those counties, you'll notice that every corner of the state has got some small community wastewater issues. If you're quick at math, or if you go over to the right-hand side, you can break those down by region, and the total at the bottom is somewhere around 1,043 small communities that have improper wastewater treatment. Okay, so that's a fairly staggering number. One thing to note about the map is there's a fair number of counties that did not return the survey, so there's potentially even more small communities that have some type of need. So this isn't a problem for just Nickelville or some of the other communities that we've heard of. This is a problem statewide. So some general things that we can do to help. I think the first and foremost at the University of Minnesota, one thing that we've been trying to do for over 30 years is educate Minnesotans of the concerns of wastewater treatment. So you'll notice in some of your materials there that we do a training program through the University of Minnesota and try and educate homeowners, professionals, politicians, everyone about proper wastewater treatment. We need to develop partnerships with 1,050 some odd small communities that need wastewater treatment. We can't do this by ourselves. The legislature can't do it by themselves. We need all of the tools at hand. So developing those partnerships across state, federal, local, private, and universities is definitely something that we need to strive for. Prioritizing communities, it's my understanding that later you will hear a presentation on how these communities are maybe prioritized in terms of which ones need dollars and when. One thing that talking to Representative Wagninius that before the meeting here, she said that we need funding, but we also need funding with some kind of knowledge or experience, that just throwing money at the problem alone does not fix the problem, that we actually need to know how to best invest this money in these communities. So just throwing money at it does not solve the problem. We need to kind of use our skills that we've developed over 30 years working with small communities to help that process along. And then finally, researching existing technology. So looking at technologies that maybe have been applied in the municipal wastewater treatment arena and looking at those for smaller communities and see what the research says in terms of performance and efficiency. So just wanted to give you a background of some of the terms that we're going to use, and you're probably going to hear from me and other people testifying here today on wastewater treatment, some of the terminology, some of the concepts, some of the trends, and the technologies that can be used. And secondly, talking a little bit about the role of our program at the University of Minnesota called the On-Site Sewage Treatment Program. So one of the first things when we talk about wastewater, we talk about the type of discharge or the type of way that we basically dispose of or get rid of the wastewater. And the two main concepts here, the first one is a subsurface or a soil-based discharge. So you treat the wastewater to a certain level and then you discharge it into the soil. So there's no direct pipe that goes to a lake, to a stream, to a ditch. It goes into the soil. Okay, that's typical in our rural areas, in our small communities. That's the way that they discharge their wastewater. Benefits of that is that the soil does some further treatment of that wastewater beyond what was done in the rest of the mechanical or process. So the soil has biological, chemical, and physical capabilities to further weather that wastewater. The other type of wastewater discharge is a surface water discharge. That's what you are familiar with when you go to a community wastewater treatment facility. I understand that, at least on the Senate side of things, that you guys, some of you visited the St. Peter and Shakopee wastewater treatment facilities. Those are surface discharge facilities. They treat the water to a certain extent, and then surface discharge, or like this picture on the bottom here, discharge that water right into a stream or river. So those are the two ways that we discharge effluent commonly in Minnesota. When we look at the soil-based discharge or soil-based treatment or subsurface sewage treatment, there's three terms that are commonly used to talk about three different sizes of systems that accept the wastewater into the soil. There's ISTS, which are individual sewage treatment systems. These are what's depicted in this photo, which is an individual home with a septic tank that collects solids in the wastewater. The solids settle out, and then there's distribution of the remaining effluent to a series of, in this case, trenches that are installed into the soil. The wastewater enters the soil. There's a minimum of 3 feet, according to Minnesota standards, of good soil that allows for treatment of microbes, of bacteria, of viruses, of nutrients in that wastewater, so that water is cleaned up substantially by the time it's ready to go into the ambient or the surrounding soil and water. MSTSs are medium-sized or cluster systems where we hook up between 5 and 30 homes to one larger septic system like what you see here. So nothing really changes except for the size of the area that we use to treat the wastewater. And then lastly, the LSTS systems, which are the large systems, they are clusters of homes over 30 homes together. And again, they're using very similar technologies to treat the wastewater. So those are the terminologies that we use to talk about individual, mid-sized, and large septic systems. Now, how that plays out, if we look at a map of a typical area, this might be in Minnesota or anywhere else, is that we can see a traditional cluster of downtown kind of area on the right-hand side of our map here, and that would be an area where it would be hard for us to treat wastewater on each individual site. So what's done here is we develop a central collection system. And you can see down in the lower corner here, a wastewater treatment facility that surface discharges after the wastewater is treated and discharges to the river. When you compare the red area, that's what we call centralized, or basically our municipal wastewater treatment facilities. When we look at the green and the blue areas, those are decentralized options where we look at individual sewage treatment systems, those ISTSs that are circled in blue, and the green areas, which are MSTS systems or clusters of five or so homes hooked together to one soil-based system. So reasons why we might do this is largely due to economic reasons, that it's most economically efficient to have a wastewater treatment facility for the downtown. But when we look at these surrounding areas, they're too spread out, that running all that piping, all that infrastructure doesn't pan out in terms of economics. Another reason we might do it might be environmental benefits, that there's no reason why we need to collect all of the wastewater in this image and put it into a centralized facility if we can achieve the same or better wastewater treatment on these individual parcels. And so there's a couple of reasons why we might advocate for this type of an arrangement or this look to Minnesota as we move forward. When we look at levels of treatment that might be provided, it's important to compare those that come from a wastewater treatment facility versus ones that are achieved by a soil-based system. Primary treatment, which it's my understanding we don't really permit in the municipal wastewater industry at this point in time, is basically the minimum level of treatment or allows first settling of the solids. In the soil-based treatment, that's a septic tank. Okay, many of you probably hear septic systems referred to as septic tanks. In Minnesota, a septic tank is not a standard sewage treatment system. So that is one piece of a sewage treatment system, but it's not the only piece. So there's not really many primary wastewater systems, either municipal or soil-based, in Minnesota. Secondary treatment, which is better, includes some things that you've probably seen on your tours: stabilization ponds, activated sludge, trickling filters, and standard soil treatment areas. So an existing soil treatment area meets some secondary or better wastewater treatment levels. When we go further to disinfection and advanced, we look at higher levels of wastewater treatment, and most of these can be achieved either in a municipal facility or in a soil-based system. So disinfection to kill remaining contaminants in the soil can be done via chlorination, UV, other methods. That can be done in a soil-based system as well as in a wastewater treatment facility. And the advanced, which is kind of the best available technologies used, might remove nitrogen, phosphorus, might use some membrane filtration. All of those things have been ported down, or those technologies have been ported down to a soil-based system as well, so that the same technologies that are advanced in a wastewater treatment plant are utilized in soil-based systems. So what is the trend in terms of these LSTS? These are the large soil-based systems in Minnesota. According to the most recent MPCA numbers, we have about 120 permitted LSTSs in the state of Minnesota, with about 80% of those permitted within the last 8 years. So that's about 100, a little less than 100 of those 120 that have been permitted fairly recently. In fact, LSTSs are the third most common category of wastewater treatment plant in the state, only behind ponds and activated sludge plants. So these LSTS, these soil-based systems, are becoming a lot more commonplace in terms of wastewater treatment. And in fact, 2.5 million gallons a day across Minnesota of wastewater are treated by LSTSs. That number is about two times the flow of the St. Peter treatment facility, the wastewater treatment facility that the Senate committee members visited a while back. So it's a fair amount of wastewater that's being treated by these soil-based systems. Beyond just using the soil and the septic tank as treatment, 70% of those LSTS systems use some type of treatment beyond the secondary treatment. So they are looking at nitrogen removal, phosphorus removal, pathogen removal, something that's beyond that secondary level of treatment. So these are quite sophisticated systems, quite accomplished in terms of their ability to remove contaminants from the wastewater stream. And then, of course, the benefit of these systems is that they are discharging into the soil. So there's an additional cleansing process or treatment process that's available as the wastewater infiltrates or percolates down into the soil before it gets to whatever receiving water that may be. So why are we seeing this trend from wastewater treatment plants to these soil-based systems? Well, if you look at the top right, cost definitely has a big role to play here. When we look at decentralized or those distributed wastewater treatment systems across the area, decentralized, we're looking at somewhere between $6,000 to maybe $15,000 per household to hook up to such a wastewater treatment facility. If we look at a traditional municipal wastewater treatment plant, that might be $13,000 to $40,000 or more dollars to hook up to that. So there's definitely an economic incentive for looking at some of these other alternatives. Environmental benefits, there may be a lot, there may be not that many, but some of that might be that the soil is actually better suited to treat some of the contaminants that are of recent concern, pharmaceuticals and things like that. We don't have a lot of data to say where and when that's possible, but it's definitely a potential. Potential for additional treatment. Once we discharge from a wastewater treatment plant into the river, there's not a lot of interactions that go on. There's not a lot of further treatment that goes on versus in the soil. We have some additional treatment capacity. And increasing technology options, that there's more and more of these technologies that are being engineered and designed for these smaller systems. Another reason why we might see more soil-based systems, I'm sure many of you are familiar with the several years ago, 2004-2005, wastewater treatment issue in Annandale-Maple Lake in the court case, which didn't permit the new wastewater treatment plant to basically have a surface discharge, so we need to think of other ways to discharge our wastewater. That obvious alternative is into the soil-based system. Since then, of course, this ruling has been overturned by the Minnesota Supreme Court, so there still can be permitted discharges of nutrients to the river, but I think the soil-based system provides a good alternative that definitely is cost-effective as well. So what the university has been doing, well, as I mentioned, we're part of the on-site sewage treatment program. That's broken down into basically four facets of activities that we do. We have a professional training program. You see in front of you one of the brochures that folds out three or four times, I think at least, is all of our professional workshops that we conduct around the state. We train all the people that install soil-based treatment systems across Minnesota, so the professionals in the industry. We train local government units, all the people that permit or regulate these things. The state staff, whether they're from the Pollution Control Agency or other agencies involved in soil-based treatment. Our program is recognized nationally, and we speak at many national and international conferences about the work that we do. The other three facets, homeowner, operation, and maintenance, that we actually have staff with the extension service that go out and teach homeowners how to use their septic system, how to treat it right, how to maintain it, how to operate it so that we achieve the optimal treatment capacity at each individual system. Small community wastewater education program is another facet of our group, and those are small community educators that go out and facilitate exactly what we're talking about. They go out and talk to those 1,000 communities that have a wastewater problem and help them grasp what that problem is, how are they going to approach it, who is going to be the leadership that is going to be in charge of figuring out the financing or the technology options, all of that kind of stuff. It's also technical in that we provide them with the tools to choose the right system for their community and facilitate partnerships with many of the other groups that are involved with the small community process. And lastly, research and demonstration projects. So figuring out what technologies work, how do they work, what are the performance of specific technologies to treat wastewater. So that is another facet of our program. Just a little bit of a breakdown of how that staff breaks out. We have about 3 full-time equivalents in the technical staff. Those are us that provide the technical training. We're funded in part by the workshops that we conduct, and the rest of our funding is soft funding. It comes from a variety of sources, whether that be research funds or additional speaking engagements, those kinds of things. 2 full-time equivalent support staff that are funded from our workshop training proceeds, and then 3 regional extension staff that are our community process and homeowner education outlet, and they are funded through extension. So that's a little bit about who we are. Partnerships is one of the things that I mentioned is a real key in terms of success with small community wastewater treatment. That none of us can do this alone. That 1,043 communities out there that have wastewater needs, we need to develop and foster partnerships. Those partnerships might be at the federal level, they might be at the state level. kind of the role of the university has been to tie all those partnerships together. That we want to make sure that the funding source knows what's happening with the technical aspects of the project. Why did it cost $10 to do X? We also want to make it clear to the homeowners why the option that was chosen was the best option. We want the community to be involved. We want the local government to understand the wastewater treatment facility so that they can help further the operation and maintenance of that facility down the road, as well as the licensed professionals and the system designers. So our staff facilitates that communication and coordination and partnership so that it exists before the project, during the project, and long after the project has been built. And that's a key to success with these communities to ensure long-term performance of these systems. This map and slide is just areas that the on-site sewage treatment program has assisted, or communities where we've provided some level of technical assistance since about 2005, so there's 12 on that list. The point of that list is that these are communities that have pursued funding to the point of an application to a funding agency, whether that be the PFA, whether that be some other type of funding. These communities have gone forward to that point. We've probably talked to an order of magnitude more than that of communities in that time, helping them move forward, but not to the point of actual engagement in a project. So you can see they're spread out across Minnesota, and the populations there are range in size from tens to a few hundred. So they're definitely on the small community size of things. The community process, how our community facilitators go about the community process, is talking about a viable solution and what that entails. And those goals are essentially the four things up here on the slide. Effective treatment, which is the obvious thing that we're all striving for. The reasonable cost, which again I think we're all trying to achieve. So what are the costs? What is the most efficient way that we can come about this project? Socially acceptable, surprisingly, this is more important than I guess I would have anticipated. That the community values, the culture, the aesthetics are all very important reasons why projects move forward or don't in these communities. So we definitely need to acknowledge and deal with the social aspect of these projects, that not everybody thinks the same way about wastewater treatment and providing those solutions. And the last one is managing that project once it's operational. So how is that taking place? So what we've noticed in working with these communities over the past 4 or 5 years is characteristics that mean successful communities. Successful communities are ones that have worked together, that have represented all of the community's interests, and developed a solution for their wastewater treatment. Some of the big keys here are getting a diverse audience, so making sure that the few dissenting people in town are involved, that they have a role in this process, and they feel ownership to this project as well. That there's effective leadership, either developed or that the community has, so that they can foresee some of the issues and deal with some of the financing and other aspects of the project. But in the middle of the list, the community assessment report is probably one of the biggest things that we've learned is a necessary aspect of a successful community. And a community assessment report we'll talk on the next slide about, but is a detailed accounting of what the community's current resources are. What is the current state of their wastewater treatment? What is their drinking water status? What is their stormwater status? How do all of these things come to play in this community? And how can we solve maybe one, maybe two, maybe all three of them in the most efficient, economically, and most effective environmental way? And the last bullet here, the monitoring, reporting, and research. So continuing to monitor these systems to know what's working, what's not working, so that we build effective systems and effective research into new systems in the future. So this community assessment report is, again, a different way of looking at and approaching small community wastewater needs than what's been done in the past. The historic way is that a consulting firm would come in, take a look at the community, and not look at parcel by parcel what the capability for wastewater treatment was. They would basically view the town as one unit and say, the wastewater treatment plant is going to go over here. And it didn't matter if two people in town had just invested in new wastewater treatment facilities, it was viewed as a whole, and you had one solution that worked for a lot of people, but those two people that had invested recently in a new septic system were kind of a little upset. And so this report involves looking at parcel by parcel what is going on in every lot. Can we treat wastewater on this particular site? And this is something that we've worked on with funders as well, so that they're now requiring this, that they've actually separated out these pre-construction grants from the construction dollars. So saying to the communities, you need to do this, you need to have this assessment done before we're going to give you money to just go ahead and build these things. So it kind of, the communities would slow down, take a step back, and really assess what are their capabilities within the community versus saying what works 5 miles down the road for this town was this wastewater treatment plant and we're going to propose the same thing here. That is kind of how things have been approached in the past, and we're trying to change that with this community assessment report. We're looking at decentralized, looking at what can be done by treating the wastewater through the soil system versus direct discharges. That's not always possible, but that would typically be the least cost option, and so those are typically investigated first. It does look like, when you look at funding, that there's some higher upfront costs when we do this, but it's just because those dollars have been separated out from the construction dollars. There's not really a true higher upfront cost. It just might appear that way when you look at the two funding streams. The community selects the best option. That the professional, the engineer, the designer, the person that is in charge of the project from a technical perspective is not saying this is your solution, that the community is actually involved. The community reviews the report and selects the best option for them. Again, based on economics, based on social impacts, environmental impacts, all of those things. And the last item here, which I've already mentioned, is that many issues compound. That if we go into community, look for a wastewater solution, and we find that we can't solve their wastewater needs without dealing with stormwater as well, or drinking water. So all of those things kind of come to bear on this assessment, and we address all of those together when we look at a community assessment report. So this is a big step forward in how we look at wastewater treatment.
Before you go ahead to the next slide, Representative Dill has a question.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius and Anderson. on the cap, I haven't been there since I got elected. I used to be chair of our wastewater treatment district, our sewer and water district, and we really stumbled with the idea of sewering our whole community, which was Crane Lake, and having new septic systems that were ISDS in that same area. And we passed an ordinance that said they had to be connected even if it was 1 day old. I mean, essentially a mandate. How is this cap going to help that problem? Because those folks were pretty upset with us.
Right, so
we just basically did it in spite of them. Are your ordinances, your model ordinances, reflecting some latitude that we can go ahead and sewer a community, get the funding, let them stay there with their new ISDSs, and then hook them up later? Is that what this cap is headed towards or doing? Because it wasn't that way, as I recall, when I was chair.
The representative, chairpersons, members of the committee. Your question is a good one. The community assessment report, so the CAR, not a cap.
Oh, cap.
But
okay,
that's okay. It might be my font is too small. Definitely allows flexibility with those systems that have been installed that are newer, that are compliant septic system. So that's the first part. As we go in, and if your system is compliant, there's no need for you to invest in what the rest of the community needs at this point. So you would be treated as a separate entity that at some point, yeah, you might be connected up in 20, 30 years if your wastewater needs were not being met on parcel.
A short follow-up, Madam Chairman. The hurdle we had, as I recall, was that if the people with the new ISTSs hooked up, we could do it for $8,000 a household. And so we mandated that they hook up. If they didn't hook up, if we didn't mandate them, we didn't have any way to to work that cost so that in 20 years when their system was ready to be replaced, they wouldn't be under a new number, which might be $25,000. And that was where we stumbled. And so we just went forward with the mandate on the day that our system was, essentially on the day our system was operable. So we kind of really, I felt, even though we went ahead with it, we kind of had a take it or leave it kind of a scenario. And I hope that, I think what you've told me is that this would allow for some latitude and also be able to get the funding for the community.
Yeah. Right. If I could add something, Chairperson and committee members, I think Otter Tail is a good example of this. The Otter Tail Management District, they actually allowed for flexibility in people to either all sign up in the beginning and then get added in later, with the understanding that if they got added in later, their costs would be substantially higher. And I know some of the newer communities, that one's 20 years old, it's been successfully managing that way for 20 years. Some of the newer communities require them to be centrally managed. So under the same management structure, under the powers of the district, understanding again that they very likely may pay a higher cost when they decide to hook into the central system, but having that be a decision that gets to be made later. So I think there is more flexibility in the current process as it moves forward. But it doesn't change your one question, which is it will drive the cost up per lot on the ones that do hook up initially. You know, if it was $8,000 per lot and right. You had 100 and now you only have 50, your cost is going to go to $16,000 per lot. So that is often why it's pushed. But the ordinances can allow for that flexibility if that's what the community ultimately really needs to best serve their wastewater treatment system.
Thank you.
So just an example of a map, not a real high-resolution example, unfortunately, but this is a car map for the city of Hadley, which is down in southwestern Minnesota. And the point of it basically is the yellow arrows pointing to the little blue ovals are showing which parcels are sending their wastewater to which little blue area, which is the soil-based treatment. So this is a small community of 80 or so, I believe, down in southwestern Minnesota, struggling with wastewater needs. And this is one of the community wastewater options for this area. So a real useful tool for the community so they can see what's happening. They can look at different alternatives, what that's going to do to their land use currently and in the future, and definitely is a different way of looking at wastewater treatment versus as one entity as the city of Hadley. So this is what we're working on developing for our small communities to get a better handle on their wastewater needs and capabilities. So how will this all end? Well, of course, being from the university, involvement in education is really what we feel is needed at all levels. We need to provide education to homeowners, the community, everyone about the importance of wastewater treatment and that they need to be involved in this process. The community assessment report is one big key that we've noticed in successful communities that developing this is a very different way of assessing needs. Knowledgeable funding sources that I've mentioned a few times, throwing money at the problem alone will not fix the problem. That understanding this community process, understanding that there's different types of treatment, different ways of treating, there's more effective ways to spend dollars, all of those things will help us in terms of the funding sources and resources. And then lastly, the monitoring, reporting, and research that we really need to enhance those capabilities, either from state funding or through university funding, to look at treatment levels, what are some of the performance of the different technologies that are out there, and help us design systems that effectively treat wastewater for the future. So with that, I think that we all understand that if we effectively treat our wastewater, that we can have our sustainability of our small communities, which I think we all are striving for. We can efficiently invest in our resources and utilize our future best management practices to help protect our waterways. Thank you.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wheeler, going back several slides, you talked about pharmaceuticals in water, and I believe you made the statement that they might better be removed or mitigated with a soil-based system. Is that based on anecdotal observation, or do you have some type of research that would point to that decision or conclusion?
Senator Chairperson, it's mostly been a suggestion. There's not a lot of data that suggests that the soil is necessarily better for treatment of pharmaceuticals, but it is a new and emerging area where there isn't a lot of research that's being done.
Madam Chair, Mr. Wheeler, it would seem to me that essentially what might be happening is just masking the presence of the pharmaceuticals. They're in the soil 3 or 4 feet, and until something disturbs them, they would just remain in that location. And a second question I have to that thing, would there be a difference with a family that has an ISPS and with just an occasional infection, occasional illness, a typical family, versus one that has a long lingering or maybe even a genetic affliction that would result in many, many years of pharmaceuticals being used and going to the same drainage bed?
Chairperson and committee members, I'd like to start with your first question as well. There has been some preliminary research done. Particularly, I'm aware of a study in Colorado where they're looking at the removal of pharmaceuticals. And there are some enhanced processes in the soil that can further, and if you think about a typical wastewater treatment plant, you're usually aerating, you're adding oxygen. There are additional treatment processes due to the microbes in the soil that under certain circumstances may degrade the pharmaceuticals. But pharmaceuticals, when you say that, there's hundreds and thousands, and that's where there's a lot of research that needs to be done in this area. As far as the retention, are we holding them in the soil, which might not be all that bad, as opposed to running into a lake, river, or stream? But the other question is it migrating? There was actually a study done out west of a school where they were actually able to track the pharmaceuticals in very sandy soils into aquifers. So it's not to say that all conditions are going to remove pharmaceuticals. Your second question about illnesses and, even something as a simple use of antibiotics and how that can impact potentially a septic system, and then looking at more long-term things like chemotherapy and long-term prescription drug use, very little research has been done in this area is the bottom line. If you look at the peer-reviewed research, there isn't any. There is a lot of anecdotal evidence, though, to say that when someone is on, for instance, a very strong antibiotic, it kills bacteria. And bacteria are a very important part of our treatment processes. So it's something we need to look into more. We do, again, have some recommendations if it's a short-term issue about how to operate your septic system if you're going to be on a batch of chemotherapy. But that being said, every chemo treatment is different. There's not a standard to follow. But the issue brought up is sometimes a larger issue for septic systems because we only have one source of wastewater. In a city, you have the dilution factor of many homes going together. So it's something we need to be aware of and we need to look into further.
Ben, I just said, what one response if there's if it's an ISPS and there's one drain field and there's long time use of a pharmaceutical, that pharmaceutical is going to go to that same drain field and accumulate, possibly accumulate there and pool there. And true, it might stay there many, many years, but sometime in the future, if something disturbs it, it'll migrate, much like pooled petroleum in the ground. It will pool and stay in one spot until it's disturbed.
Chairperson and committee members, it may or it may stay in one spot. We really don't know. And in most instances, the contaminants we're talking about aren't something like petroleum. So it's kind of a different beast. And until we really look at the issue further, we haven't, again, seen evidence of widespread contamination in many wells from these sorts of sources.
Senator Fredrickson, that sounds like the very perfect LCCMR project.
Mm-hmm.
If we can get a, Madam Chair, if we can get a proposal to propose doing something
mm-hmm.
like that, good research.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see other questions. Oh, I do. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hoppe, for relaying the message. I had a question, and maybe I missed it. When we're talking about the new soil-based treatments with the increasing technology options, is there a limit to the size of a community most of these communities are small. Are we talking about soil-based for these, or are we talking about in the future having even larger systems that are soil-based? What would be the maximum resident number?
Chairperson and committee members, to date, we kind of have historic things and then we have kind of looking to the future. I think some of the larger LSTS systems are in the 30 to 40,000 gallon per day limit. Understanding the average person, they usually estimate uses around 75 gallons per day. So I can't tell you exactly how many people that is, but we are seeing them. Those 30 and 40,000 have been newer LSTSs, meaning we're seeing the size increase. But when you start making soil-based systems larger, you have to think about we are dispersing and treating all this wastewater below the ground. But that's the big difference, is we need to get it all accepted into our soils, and that means you need to have the right soil characteristics to do that. So I don't think that there's necessarily, I can't give you that 300 is the number. It's really based on the soil characteristics. But there probably gets to be a point, too, where economically, if you have that, a large amount of people, that one of those centralized options may make more economic sense. But then that's more based on density of the homes. Because with the larger wastewater treatment plants, much of the cost is in the collection, particularly when you get into larger lots.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't know which one of you is better to ask this or answer this, but I'm interested in when you talk about pharmaceuticals in the wastewater stream. Are those pharmaceuticals having people are just throwing away into the wastewater stream, or having gone through people, or a combination? Is there any research about what the source of the problem is?
Chairperson and committee members, it's actually both sources. So hopefully we're going to see less and less of it being thrown away. There's still, though, I have a friend who just went through a nursing program where in the hospital they were actually taught how to properly dispose of unwanted pharmaceuticals by flushing them down the drain, where the second nurse watched the first nurse flush so they could make sure that it, and this was just a year ago at a hospital in the metropolitan area, and I was amazed at that. So that being said, though, most of, I think, what we're seeing in our systems is actually stuff that's passed through people's bodies. Some of it metabolized and some of it not. So I think both sources are something over the long term we're going to have to deal with. The first one's easier. We can probably, deal with, the unused pharmaceuticals. But the ones that have passed through us are something we're going to have, a challenge we're going to have to face in both our septic systems, our small-scale systems, and our wastewater treatment plants.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Over at Farm Fest, over by Senator Bickerman's area, I saw a mechanical individual sewage treatment system. And this was inside the home, and it had no discharge to my knowledge. there again, you know, that's the kind of environment that you might see snake oil salesmen, but I really was intrigued by the possibility of not having to have a drain spill at home at all and having an individual sewage treatment system operate from a mechanical, I mean, imagine chemical basis also. Have you ever heard of such a thing? And is there, this came from Australia, and maybe that helps you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, chairperson and committee members, there actually is a system from Minnesota I'm aware of that does what you're describing. It's called the Aquara system. But the principle is basically you have the mechanical plant primarily located in your basement, and they have a composting unit for your toilet water and then a gray water treatment system that basically goes through processes to make it to potable drinking water standards. For some people, it's still a big leap to drink that wastewater, but but in many states and many applications, they're using that for reuse. Things like toilet flushing or irrigation. In other states where water is much more of a commodity, we're seeing a lot more reuse of wastewater. I mean, if you've been to Vegas anytime recently, they have some green strips down the middle. That's all wastewater. So I think in the future, we will do a lot more beneficial reuse of our wastewater. If you go to more across the pond, even over to Europe, they're thinking about this nitrogen and phosphorus. We're worried about it impacting our drinking water, our surface waters. They're thinking about how can we capture these nutrients and reuse them, right? We're applying anhydrous ammonia to our fields. Can't we use the ammonia from that we excrete as a fertilizer? So if you want to look even further, that's the direction we're going to be going, is reusing more of our wastewater instead of trying to dispose of it, because it really is actually in many countries a resource.
I have a follow-up. I think you just described the space program, because they recycle everything.
Representative Joe.
Thank you, Chair Wagenius, and Representative Gunther, and to the testifiers, I think Representative Olson and I sponsored some legislation that actually clarified, is that the same type of system you're referring to, that clarified some of the plumbing codes? And actually my neighbor up at Crane Lake in their basement had one of these systems installed, and up in Grand Marais, I know they're very prolific, the number that are being installed, and they use rainwater off the roof, and it actually, they're just as you described. This is a company in Minnesota, I think in Egan, that manufactures it, and we did some work for them to help make it so that counties could actually permit it. Is that right?
Chairperson and committee members, there was legislation because it actually technically violated the plumbing code as it was proposed. Right. I do want to add just a little bit more about that. It's not, when we talk about cost for systems, with that system, many people don't even have a well. Like, they're catching their rain. I mean, it's a whole nother kind of level of wastewater treatment. And in most instances, we've seen financially feasible when very, very few other options exist. And I'm aware of, you know, there's probably in the range of 10 to 20 of those in the state. They're still a relatively emerging idea and concept. But it's, again, something I think we likely may see more of in the future, particularly with more challenging lots. I mean, we have sites in Minnesota that don't have soil. I know some of these were put in bedrock situations where the cost of hauling in soil or blasting rock and things like that was cost prohibitive.
Representative
Wagenius, Chair Wagenius and Anderson. If you picture my neighbor's house, now my lot is way better. I have all kinds of soil on mine. I don't know why, but I really have a really good lot, and I have an in-the-ground compliant system. But my neighbors, if you imagine looking at the lake, they have no soil. I mean, it's nothing but just a solid piece of granite, and then rather than catch rainwater, they're using water out of the lake for their drinking water and running it through a purification system. And this thing fits in their basement. I would say it's an area about 15 by 20 by 8 feet tall in their basement, and it's like a Willy Wonka chocolate factory to me. I mean, stuff goes in, but something comes out that I wouldn't probably drink, but they're using it. So anyway, I don't know how it works, but it was just installed, and it's right in my neighbor's house, so it must work. Very expensive.
Well,
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Dill, it's not in Eagan, it's in Afton, and it's a constituent of mine. I have my glass on Elston, and I do have the information here, Madam Chair, so if anybody wants it. It is, by today's standards, rather expensive. It's like $50,000. But the potential, on an individual basis, but the potential for our constituents that want to live in Representative Dill's district in the summer on the rocks, it could be a great summer home. So there's a lot of good potential. So anybody wants the information, I do have it, Madam Chair.
So, any other questions? Did you have somewhere you wanted to continue with?
Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, thank you for coming. We really appreciate it. The beneficial reuse word is a good one for us to keep in mind, though I think of my own city, which is Minneapolis, the water we drink is probably could be characterized as beneficial reuse. So this is not necessarily a new concept. Maybe one that we should use more often. Thank you all very much for coming. Next we have Dr. Roger Ruin, professor at the University of Minnesota. Very grateful that he could be with us today. Members should know that I first read about him in the New York Times, and not every Minnesotan gets an article written about them in the New York Times. This was in last December.
And we had it. We have members.
Okay. Oh, super. Thank you.
It's in front of all of you.
You all did that, huh?
I don't know. Did I do that?
Some staff did that.
Some smart staff.
They brought them.
Okay. Good job passing them out. Welcome to the committee, and if you would introduce both yourselves for the record, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Roger Ruin. I'm a professor in bioproducts and biosystems engineering, and I'm also the director for Center for Biorefining at the University of Minnesota.
My name is Bob Polka. I'm with the Metropolitan Council of Environmental Services and manage the research and development section there.
Well, again, thank you, Madam Chairs and representatives and senators. I'm very happy to be here today to discuss with you about algae for a better environment and energy security. Now, as you all know, this petroleum oil is not only an energy security issue, okay, but it's also caused a lot of environmental pollution problems. Now, recent years, we have, in this state specifically, we have a lot of corn ethanol and soybean biodiesel, and those industries just helped in the rural economic development. But it's still a lot of other issues, especially environment issues, to be solved. And also, we simply will not have enough land to produce enough corn or soybean to produce ethanol and biodiesel to be enough to make a difference. And also, these will probably not long-term sustainable. So recently, there's a lot of interest in cellulosic biomass. Okay, and there are a lot of cellulosic biomass. Unfortunately, all these cellulosic biomass, they are all distributively produced. So they are everywhere. So it has to be collected and harvested and transported to a centralized location. And these cellulosic biomass, they are all different kinds of cellulosic biomass. So you have to go through different kind of pretreatment, use different kind of enzyme in order to convert them into ethanol. Okay. So now these are very, very expensive processes to build a plant of about 40 to 50 million gallons, that kind of ethanol plant from cellulosic biomass. It will cost you at least $300 million. because you need a lot of enzyme loading, so you have to build an enzyme plant right there, and you need to build a power plant to utilize all those lignins and so on. Okay, so again, these also cellulosic ethanol is extremely expensive, and that's the reason there's a lot of interest right now for algae production for the biofuels and energy. Okay, and actually, just a few weeks ago, there's a algae biomass summit in San Francisco. There are about 400 people came, and they are all very interested in these microscopic green algae. Their size is only about, what, 1 to about 10 micrometers, that kind of range in their diameter. Of course, there are different kinds of structures and so on. Now, these microalgae, they are basically microscopic aquatic plants, and they can carry out the same processes and mechanisms of photosynthesis as higher plants in converting the sunlight, water, and CO2 into the biomass and water. So why microalgae? First of all, they have much, much greater productivity than their terrestrial cousins. And they are not really food products, so they don't compete with food. And they can use otherwise non-productive land. And also they can treat and utilize both saline and also fresh waters. And they can utilize all the nutrients in those wastewaters and so on. And also they can utilize the waste CO2, which is main greenhouse gas we are talking about every day, how to reduce this. And this will be a perfect way. Later on you will see the data. It can actually consume or utilize a lot of CO2. And also it can be used in conjunction with the wastewater treatment plant, and that's actually a major advantage there. Later on we'll talk about, because in wastewater there's plenty of these nutrients, phosphorus and nitrogen we are trying to remove, and this is almost a perfect way to remove that. In fact, we actually, Minnesota has a company before called Lemna Corporation, basically using the duckweed to grow duckweed on wastewater to exactly doing this purpose of wastewater treatment. Basically to remove the phosphorus, to remove the nitrogen from this wastewater for the sole purpose of cleaning the wastewater. Okay. So these, of course, you know, they can grow much faster. And these algae, if you have these wastewater treatment plants grow these algae, you can have an algal biorefinery right there, and they can actually produce oils, proteins, and carbohydrates, and so on. And these oils can be converted into biodiesel. These carbohydrates can be used to produce ethanol, for example. And the key difference is now all these are all in one location. Okay, you don't have a transportation issue there. All these in one location, and all these are uniform species. So you don't have to have different kind of pretreatment. You don't have to have different kind of enzymes and so on. Okay, so that's a major difference there. And also some of these species, they not only grow fast, but they also have very, very high oil content, from 50 or sometimes even as high as 75% in some of the strains. So these are comparison of the gallons of oil per acre per year for some of these oil producing crops. You look at these corn and soybean from about 18 to 48 gallons per acre per year of oil produced, as compared to these microalgae, about 5,000 or to 15,000 gallons per acre per year. So that's a major, a few orders difference. Yeah. And later on you will see even more dramatic data there. So assuming that we now want to replace all the transportation fuels in the United States by these biodiesel. Right now in the United States we consume about 60 billion gallons of diesel fuels and about 120 billion gallons of gasoline. So if we all converted to using biodiesel, for example, then we will need about 140 gallons of biodiesel. So these, if we assume that we have about 15,000 gallons per acre of oil produced, which means we can easily convert these oils into the same amount, about 15,000 per gallon of biodiesel per acre. So that basically saying that we need about 9.5 million acres of land. And that's about 1/6 of the state of Minnesota. In other words, we need about 1/6 of the state of Minnesota, the surface area, then we can produce enough liquid fuel for the whole United States use, current use. So that's a major, major significance there. And that's the reason why so many people are interested in algae, in its potential right now. And of course, this is a clean technology. And that's what we mentioned earlier. It basically can utilize all these wastewaters, you know, all the nutrients in the wastewater, and it can utilize the CO2 in the food gas. Okay, so again, through the sunlight, you can convert these into the algae biomass that contains oil that can be converted into biodiesel or other residues that can be used for the ethanol production. So again, why algae? First of all, it grows very fast. You're talking about a lot of these, I mean, these microalgae are basically, you know, fast-growing photosynthetic organisms. And they can actually complete the entire growing cycle every few hours to two days. So that means you pretty much can harvest every day. Okay. And again, of course, some of them have very high oil content, you know, and not just the oil content, the overall biomass yield is very high. So that's a major difference. And of course, they are environmental friendly. As we mentioned, you know, they are actually a good technique just used for the wastewater treatment itself, let alone use it as an energy crop. Again, using algae to treat the water itself is already very significant. And of course, this whole process and the product itself are green, and also these products can be completely utilized. Okay. So, of course, they are highly renewable. Again, you can produce every few hours. So these, for example, are the algae from the local pond. Okay. Now, right now, the algae production are mainly through these open pond systems. The problem with these open pond systems is this light penetration issue. The light only penetrates about 10 centimeters or so. Okay. So, because especially when you have a lot of algae growth, the light doesn't penetrate much at all. So now this is very inefficient use of the space if you use open pond system to grow this algae. And of course, this open pond system, if you continue to grow this algae, you will have a lot of issues like water evaporation and also all these sedimentations and so on. So it may not be long-term sustainable. And also, you might be difficult to control the nutrients, to control the temperatures and so on. Okay. And it's different kind of species. We want species, of course, that can tolerate all these conditions, you know, wastewaters and so on. And they can have a lot of oils and grow very, very fast. Okay. But these, if it's open system, sometimes it's kind of difficult to control. But that's what most of the research right now are basically the open pond systems. So let me show you some of the ongoing efforts we are working on. You know, one thing, of course, is try to screening all kind of algae species. Basically, you know, we want them to be able to grow very fast, but still, you know, tolerate all the very, even the dirtiest wastewater we have. Okay. And also we hope they also have high oil content. Okay. And we want to develop these kind of closed or hybrid kind of photobioreactors, because now you will be able to solve those water evaporation issues. You'll be able to much easily control the environment, the temperature, the nutrients and so on. And of course there's a lot of other things you need to be worked on, for example, harvesting, because these algae are again very small. So you have to develop, you know, technique to efficiently harvest them, and also to extract the oil from them, and also to convert all these algal biomass into the fuels or materials and so on, in order to utilize these fuels. And looking at, again, practical pilot commercialized schemes and so on. Now these are, for example, some of the algae cultures in our lab. It's again all kind of algae cultures, and right now we test a range of different kind of species. And actually, in University of Minnesota, we have a worldwide collection center. It's a kind of service center, provides, you know, everyone in the world with these Chlamymona, you know, species, which we have over, you know, 3,000 these green algae species there. But we screen just preliminary. These Chlamymona, these species that we have right now, they actually tolerate very well in, again, the dirtiest wastewater we have right now, the centers, okay? And the oil content is already very good without any optimization right now. It's about 21% of oil in this dry biomass. So that, again, is already very significant. And we also, as I mentioned, working on different kind of code systems. Okay. We have different kind of triangle systems, tubular systems, and we also, this actually is a picture that you see in New York Times, in the Washington Post, in a lot of other medias and so on. So, but we also looking at this new development of the reactors. And the key difference is now you use much, much higher depth of water by circulate water and let it fall down to fully utilize the sunlight. So this light administration is very, very efficient. So now this way you can again reduce much more of the space requirements, because instead of what we are talking about earlier, carrier saturation of 1/6 of the state of Minnesota, now that's again based on the open pond system with the penetration of about 10 centimeters. But now with this kind of new system saturation, this kind of new efficient light utilization system, you can use much less of the space. Right now the system we have is about 1 meter depth of water you can utilize. So these basically again by folding this water, and then you know it works. It can again efficiently utilize the light and the CO2s and so on. So these, for example, are some of the data we have. As you can see, this one here is these Pneumomonas grow on this centrate. That's again the very concentrated wastewater, you know, with a lot of nutrients, but kind of dirty wastewater. So these again is, you see it grows very well, reach almost 3,000 optical density. That basically saying that at these kinds of, you know, grow, if it grows so well, then you can harvest about 2 grams of dry biomass per liter of wastewater per day. So that's extremely significant amount of the algae dry biomass you can harvest. So if we use, for example, these Metro Council Environment Service Metro Plant as an example. The Metro Plant right now has a capacity of, right now, to treat about 185 million gallons of wastewater per day. So we can remove all its, you know, just assuming that we only remove half of its phosphorus, for example, and then the which is will be about 2 tons and so on. And, you know, if we add, you know, phosphorus, and we can actually grow even more. But anyway, we can easily remove all these nutrients in the wastewater, and we can also produce a lot of biomass. Right now, again, if assuming we only remove about 2 tons, you know, of phosphorus, then we can actually produce about 100 tons of dry biomass per day, or if assuming 20% of oil only in the dry biomass, then we can produce 20 tons of oil per day. But again, theoretically, based on these 185 million gallons of water, if we consume all nutrients, or if we provide additional nutrients like, you know, animal manures or some of other, you know, again, just adding the urea or these kind of very cheap, you know, fertilizer if necessary, then we can grow, even for these 185 million gallon plants, we can produce, you know, about 280 tons of oils per day. So that's extremely significant amount. That means you can have a biodiesel plant over 100,000 tons. So that's a major significant, you know, per year. Now, right now, all these algal biomass after the oil being extracted, okay, this remaining algal biomass, which is still a lot, right now it's mainly through this anaerobic digestion, okay. But anaerobic digestion requires a long residence time, usually about 15 days or more. So that means these are larger amounts, and you need that kind of residence time. So you need a huge, huge space just remaining algal biomass. Okay. So that's also one of the things that we are working on, is to try to use continuous hydrothermal process to convert these kind of biomass into the bio oil. So instead of, you know, these dry biomass and then going through anaerobic digestion, we simply just keep it wet and then directly go through its hydrothermal process to convert them into bio-oils. And then these bio-oils, you know, just because of bio-oil, there's also issues related to these bio-oils, you know, like highly acidic and so on. So we go through different kind of bio-oil refining, okay, to try to produce different grades of oils, like in this case, again, heavy and light fractions. Some fraction can be mixed directly with the diesel, some fraction can be mixed with the gasoline directory. These are mixing with gasoline, for example. And also at the Center for Biorefining, we also convert these kind of bio-oil, these kind of liquid bio-polyol and so on, into different kind of polymers, into polyurethane forms, into polyester, you know, films, into adhesives, and of course into fuels also. Okay. And these are actually done at the Center for Biorefining, which is part of a larger renewable energy program at University of Minnesota. We have Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment. You all know that's funded by the state legislature with the Excel, you know, fund. And its mission is basically to promote the statewide economic development, sustainable, healthy, and diverse ecosystems, and national energy security through development of bio-based and other renewable resources and processes. Now, what's unique about these systems, again, is one is the reactor design. You can utilize much deeper water, so much less space, and you can efficiently utilize the light, rather than that light only penetrate about 10 centimeters. And also, you can use the wastewater, and also using the CO2 from the wastewater treatment plant, or from a power plant that produce a lot of CO2 every day, or ethanol plant, for example, almost a third goes to the, you know, CO2 right now. And we are actually screening all these high oil content and robust, you know, algae species, which right now, very preliminary, we already have a species, you know, that again goes well on wastewater and have quite reasonable oil content. And of course, the other uniqueness is we don't have to go through this, you know, larger scale anaerobic digestion type of system to utilize the remaining algal biomass. So that's another major development in this program. So the program right now, our plan is, of course, to continue to try to screen through these different kind of species to develop these kind of different kind of bioreactors and harvest extraction and conversion techniques, and also test all these production schemes and develop and test on-site demo systems at the Metro Council Environmental Services Metro Plant. You know, we are going to have actually the demo, you know, pilot demo system there, and then of course we want to conduct techno-economic and environmental impact analysis, and of course to develop these kind of scale-up parameters for these, you know, pilot production scale system development. Now, right now the partners, of course, we have Metro Council Environment Service. You know, Dr. Bob Portas is actually the research manager there at the Metro Council Environment Service. And we have these IREE, right now actually there are over 30 faculty interested in these algae program mm-hmm. through IREE at University of Minnesota. Mm-hmm. And we are also working with University of Minnesota Morris campus, Nancy Carpenter and others. They are helping us screening different kind of algae species. And early on I mentioned about these, you know, Plemmonos, you know, this species, this, you know, center. Housing all these different kind of species of these green algae, you know, Pete, Lavelle, and also Caroline, they are helping us also screening these kind of different algae species. And Excel is also helping us, you know, by giving us funding in addition to the Metro Council's, you know, funding and, you know, University of Minnesota IRIS funding some of the initial seed grants and so on. And Donaldson Company is interested in helping us harvest these kind of, you know, algae species. Again, these are fine algae. They need to be harvested efficiently, otherwise it's going to be expensive. And 3M also interested in helping us improve the light administration in these photobiosynthesis, you know, photobioreactors. And of course, this, and other, you know, venture capitalists, including this green capital, they are extremely interested in this also, and they like to work with us, you know, in these areas also. So right now, national-wise, actually international-wise, there's a lot of interest in these algae. And currently, all these algae production, there's only a few larger scale ones, but they are mainly for these cosmetic industries, they're for, you know, nutraceutical food industries and so on. So they do have a few football sites, that kind of field, open pond systems for the production of algae, but mainly for those purposes, not for the, again, wastewater treatment as what we are trying to do, and not for algae as an energy crop that we are trying to combine with treating wastewater and the energy crop production. So, and actually I visited some of them. One is actually in Hainan province in China, and there are a few in Taiwan, a few in Australia, and so on. So even in Arizona, there's a couple of them. They are in California, they're trying to set up this kind of open pond system right now. So we do think that right now this is quite unique opportunity for us here in Minnesota. So thank you very much.
There are questions. Excellent presentation. Senator Kubley.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair and Dr. Rowan. Well, I have several questions here. I'll give them to you one at a time, I guess. Part of the difficulty, and I was out of the room for a little bit, so if I missed one of these, I apologize for that. But, you know, you've got your own method of measuring the tons of oil per day that could be gained from, I guess part of my question would be, you know, how does that convert to the number of barrels of oil that might be replaced? Is it a one-for-one ratio, or, you know, based on the number of calories of energy that you could get out of a ton of algae oil, if you want to call it that, I guess. You know, is there a conversion factor there, or how would you compare the two?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. Yes, that for the oil conversion into the biodiesels, it's pretty much one-to-one conversion, okay?
Okay.
Now, there's 1 gallon of oil you can produce from algae, then you can obtain about 1 gallon of biodiesel. And that 1 gallon of biodiesel, the heating value is about the same as the diesel we have right now. So that, again, is pretty much almost one-to-one conversion. That's a little bit different as compared to the ethanol. Ethanol is only about 60% of the, you know, diesel, for example, because the heating value is much lower, you know, ethanol as compared to the diesel fuel.
Yeah, well, thank you. And a follow-up, Madam Chair, I guess. Then, I assume that since this is a biological product, that the emissions would be significantly lower than it would be from a petroleum-based product. Is that accurate or not?
Again, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. Yes, you know, the key is right now what you're converting is the CO2 and waste nutrients like phosphorus and nitrogen in the wastewater.
Mm-hmm.
But what you come out is the biomass and the oxygen. So it's actually algae is very, very efficient way in producing oxygen. It's probably a lot better than some of the other plant species in that point of view. So it certainly is very green, this whole process.
Okay, then one more thing, Madam Chair, I guess. You mentioned, always wonder about the lifespan when you talk about the number of tons of day that could be gained. I mean, it obviously has a very short lifespan. And how do you know, you know, with the number of species of algae that there are out there, how do you know what the optimum time for harvest is on any given species? You know, I guess that's a perplexing thing to me, but you've probably researched that.
Again, thank you, Madam Chair and Senator. Yes, that's exactly what we are researching. You see that I show you a range of different kinds of species right now. There's a lot of literature of all different kinds of species available out there. Although none of that right now they're talking about for the energy crop or production yet, okay. But we do have some idea of their growing cycles, in other words, how long does it take for them to split every hours or every days, or, you know, how many hours per day and so on. And also what kind of composition they are in there. For example, how much carbohydrate are there, how much oil, you know, are there. And also, sometimes, you know, even oil itself, you have different profiles, okay, 18 carbon oils or whatever, you know, again, different kinds of oils, you know, there. So then you hopefully can convert into, you know, different, like, you know, biodiesels or jet fuels and so on. So yeah, there are a lot of data, and that we actually search all those literatures. And again, you know, we do have a very good program at University of Minnesota, which they do very, very, very fundamental studies, because they actually have a center, as I mentioned. That center is a service center for the whole world, to provide the whole world with some one of that kind of species, which again, right now they have over 3,000 collections in there, you know, and they have some of this data there. So, and of course, we go through, you know, the Texas, their collections, Hawaii, their collections, and look at you know, different species, what kind of nutrient they require to grow. Are they, you know, saltwater, you know, species, or they are freshwater species, and what kind of, you know, carbon dioxide requirements, and what kind of, you know, oil content in the species, and so on. So we look through, and then we select a few, and then we screen ourselves for our own wastewaters and see how well they grow here, how well they can adapt here, how tolerable they are to the very dirty wastewater that we have, and then for this whole, you know, period of the temperature changes and so on. So that's what, you know, that's exactly what we are doing.
Okay. Yes. Well, Madam Chair, you know, I guess I'd like to, I think this is fascinating enough, it might be in the interest of both of our committees from both chambers to make a field trip one day over to you to take a look at this process. And, you know, could I ask Dr. Newman one more question? I guess, you know, with all of the emphasis today on the biological engineering, I mean, is the whole process of genomics and how you might alter that to produce more oil from an algae species, is that part of your research, or is that a separate entity that would be looking at something like that?
Again, thank you, Madam Chair and also Senator. Right now, you know, these optimizations are very preliminary, and a lot of work can still be done just by, you know, these, you know, different kind of species and their optimization itself. They can have tremendous improvement. Of course, potentially in the future, you could consider, for example, some of the genetic modification and so on to produce much, much higher yield, for example, and to be able to survive even at very low temperature, no light, you know, all those kinds of things. But those probably are much more long-term. We are not involved at this stage at all. You know, there are people doing that kind of work, but we are not. We are looking at, again, because right now, these are very, very preliminary optimization. Although already we get pretty high, you know, already very significant kind of yields of the oil and the biomass, algal biomass. So just by doing this, we already, you know, probably can actually be significant enough to actually commercialize this. That's why it's so much interest right now. And to go through that genetic modification, there are some concerns there. For example, how would these species potential contaminants of other species, because these are talked about in the water, okay? So these, even though we can try our best to close systems and so on to clean through, to get rid of all of these, you know, algal biomass before they go, the water is discharged into the river stream and so on, but you might still have some concerns. So that's what we are not considering that in the near future. Maybe, you know, some others are, but we haven't.
Senator Anderson has the next question.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, let's sit here listening to this, and what you're trying to do is great. You have to remember that I represent farmers, and I put together the ethanol bill way, way back, because corn is $1.10 to $1.25, and beans were $3.95 to maybe $4. By doing that in those 10 years, we've raised corn to $4.50 or better, and soybeans the other day on the board were over $14. So I hope that we don't walk away from that issue, because these farmers out in my area, they're building a new one in Lamberton, $110 million, mm-hmm. and that's all farmer investment. So what you're doing, I agree with that, but let's don't forget what we originally started out for, the raise the price to farmers in the state.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. And that's exactly why I agreed, because these, you know, corn, ethanol, and soybean biodiesel, they did make a major difference in the rural economic development, and they did help the rural development in the rural economic situation and so on. So I certainly think that is important. And these will be just additional, because even that, we can still do much more, but it will not make a major difference in the microfuel use, in replacing the petroleum oils. But these additional things, I'm not saying that we shouldn't do those things. Those are opportunities we have to seize, okay? But these are additional opportunities that I think that could potentially make a major difference in the, you know, our relying on the, you know, imported fuels.
Thank you. Senator Anderson is next.
I'm just trying to understand where you're at, practically speaking, and, you know, how... I guess I'd like to know a little bit more about the Met Council project. You know, what is actually going to happen? How big is the scale of this project, and what will you be doing with the waste product that you, or the waste product, the oil, the products that come out, the biomass that comes out of the wastewater treatment? And, you know, would you say if we could magically come up with a bunch of money, is that the major obstacle? What are the obstacles to getting some kind of a real commercial scale project going with this in Minnesota, where we could produce the algae and use it as an energy source today or tomorrow? You know, could we make that happen?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Anderson. Yeah, that's actually a good question. That's what we are trying to figure out right now. But basically, our plan right now is, you know, we are going to have actually an on-site system to directly using the sensory, for example, which is part of wastewater from these, you know, and directly going through our continuous system and then treat these sensory wastewater, okay? And at the same time produce the harvest, the, you know, algal biomass, okay? And then, now, you know, to actually treat this water, okay, that part, it's, we are very confident that we can do that using algae. Now, after these algae are harvested, first of all, can we harvest them efficiently? Right now, we do, and we have to, we do in a very, very small scale, but again, that we need to test, you know, how efficient we can be at a larger scale. That's why we ask people to help us, like the these different companies that I mentioned there, for example, Donaldson. And also, in the system itself, the photobioreactor itself, that again can treat the wastewater, but how good they can utilize these light. So that's why we ask these 3M to help us, you know, these in the light administration, in other words, most efficiently utilize the light. And after that, you know, you have this, how do you get oil out? So we're working with different companies, you know, to try to get oil out. We have our technologies. Again, they are small scale systems. So I think the best way is to work with all these industries to get their state of the art technologies to apply into this one. Because some of those are kind of standard technology application into these, you know, application right now. So our case right now, the key is, can you actually grow enough algae with enough oil content efficiency, large amounts of them, if we can do that. And that's the reason for us to actually do on-site, to try to use as much as their sensor, for example, as their concentrated wastewater, for example, to try to, first of all, help them solve this wastewater, you know, treatment issue. And then, when we have these kind of, you know, algal biomass, now, with all these different kind of companies to work with us to try to hopefully, you know, as soon as possible, you know, to have some kind of commercially viable technology. You know,
what are you going to do with the biomass after you harvest it in your in this project?
Right now, in this
I have a place that could use it. I have a. I just want to know when it's going to be ready. I got a thank really you, good plant in St. Paul that needs a good source of biomass.
And thank you. Yes, and these, the key is, as soon as you have enough algal biomass and enough oil, from oil to biodiesel, we have a number of plants in Minnesota already.
Okay.
They will be so happy to take your oil, okay, to convert it into biodiesel.
And
so that's not an issue.
So which, would that be like a coke refining type of plant, or who would refine that, or like an just a bio refinery that, that does biodiesel could take this product and make it into biodiesel?
Yeah, again, thank you. And the center. Yes, you know, those plants right now, we already have a few soybean oil biodiesel plants.
Okay.
And they can actually, combine these oil into it, because there's no big difference, no much big difference at all, and no technical, technology difficulty in converting this oil into the biodiesel. And the remaining algal biomass, there are also a number of ways, as I mentioned. One way is to simply ferment it into ethanol, for example.
Mm-hmm.
Because right now, what you have is on one location with so much of these algal biomass, and uniform variety. So you don't have to have different kind of pretreatment. You don't have to have different kind of enzyme and so on. Mm. So a lot of these corn ethanol plants, for example, they were happy to take on these additional, you know, raw materials for them to convert into. Or, I also mentioned earlier about the thermochemical type of conversion ways to convert these kind of algal biomass into the bio oil, and then we can actually fractionate them into fuels mixable with diesel or mixable with gasoline and so on. So these, right now the key is, can you produce enough algae economically?
Mm-hmm.
That's the key right now.
Madam Chair and Senator, could I address the issue of timing? We hope by the middle of this year to have a small continuous flow system at Metro, maybe a liter per minute.
Yeah.
Very small, just to get enough material so we can look at how we separate the algae from the flow, because that's going to be very important and maybe difficult. After that, we envision something like a pilot facility, maybe 5 gallons a minute, compared to our normal flow of 185 million gallons a day. It's relatively small, but it would give us a good indication of what how the technologies are going to work. Full scale is a number of years off.
Thank you.
And let me add this a little bit, Madam Chair and Senator. We are also working with a program called DARPA, okay, Defense, you know, that program, research program. And what they are interested in, you know, working with us, but they want to move much quickly than we, you know, want here, okay. So we are trying our best to meet those deadlines. In other words, in 2 years, they want to be commercial, you know, commercialized. But that we don't know whether we'll be able to do it. We don't know anyone can do it. Mm-hmm. But again, we think we are in a much better position than a lot of other people in the country. So,
one more question, if I may. Madam Chair, that reminds me of Senator Kubley's question. I'm not sure if you were asking about the emissions from burning this diesel. I'm not sure if you answered that part of it. If you actually make this biodiesel from algae, has anyone looked at what the emissions from using that bio, burning that would be compared to other, I mean, it would probably be like a soy product or something comparable to that, or do you know?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator, again. There are some people, you know, doing this kind of work right now, but not specifically analyzing the emissions from these algal oil produced biodiesel. But the assumption is they are very, very similar, exactly like what you said, to the soybean and all to all plant oils, which, again, it should be more, you know, it should burn a little bit more completely, and it should be able to help even the engine because of lubrication effect and so on. So all the benefit that's there with biodiesel should still be here, including environmental benefit also. Thank you.
Senator Kubley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess just in response to that, Senator Anderson, I think that as a general rule, even though I don't think it's universal, the emissions from a biological source are generally less than they are from a petroleum source, which is a biological source of sorts, but it's millions of years old. But, you know, I guess, Professor Ruin, I guess one more question. You know, in the agricultural community, you know, we've had some problems with monocropping that people are becoming more and more concerned with that I think we're going to have to address sooner or later. And part of that is the cost of promoting, you know, a source of production or a style of production that depends on monocropping. You know, and so the application of herbicides and pesticides, that kind of thing, which I think has some growing concerns about it, at least that's what I get when I talk to people that live in my district. You know, I mean, might there be some of those same kinds of things if you find one species of algae that produces a much better volume of oil than other species? Are you going to have to try and limit the production and what might be necessary in order to do algae farming on a monocropping basis?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator. Again, that's a very, very good question. And that's why we are optimizing these for, because everywhere, you know, you have different kind of, you know, climate conditions. You have different kind of water source. Some of it is salt water, some of them is fresh water, and some of them have different kind of nutrients and so on. So for every of these kind of different situations, you will certainly have different kind of species that best fit for those. So you will certainly see many, many, many different varieties of these. You know, right now, for example, we are using this, you know, Camomonas species, which again in Arizona they use totally different kind of species, okay? And in Hawaii, again, different kind of species. And then also all those saltwater species are totally different, some of them without even the need for this light. So again, you will have all these kind of diversity already in a lot of different kinds of, you know, situations. Right now, we optimize this for the purpose of wastewater treatment, and at the same time produce enough, you know, energy crops, okay? But others, for example, you know, use fresh water, you know, just for the solely purpose of growing these, you know, energy crops. Then the nutrient you use, and all these, like, for example, ureas or animal waste and so on that you use, in, you know, and the temperature control, they will probably require totally different kind of species to optimize for that condition. So, yeah, but that is a good point we have to address to make sure, you know, we don't, you know, these have to be long-term sustainable. That's why we're also looking at the environmental impact on this. So, thank you.
Well, just one more comment, Madam Chair. It does seem to me that that there are a number of applications for some of the biotechnology pieces that go on today that are really quite benign in their application. There are others that I have some concerns about. You know, it may be fine when you're growing them in an enclosed system, but, you know, if they find their way into the natural environment, they become quite malignant. And so, you know, how do we gain some assurances from the industry that, you know, that those kinds of problems have been addressed before the possibility arises and we have a huge problem on our hands?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and again, thank you, Senator. And this is a very good point, and these, even right now, it's already exists in our, you know, for example, our current wastewater treatment plant, okay? It is already different kind of algal species in the wastewater, and we just simply have to ensure that none of that actually gets into the rivers, it gets into outside. Right now, for example, we are already doing that. We already make sure that none of these algae species actually contaminate the fresh water, the rivers, and so on. So that is important. We still have to ensure whatever species that we do, you know, eventually when this water is being, you know, discharged into the rivers, into the lake, we have to ensure there's no of these kind of algal species. You know, just like what we currently do, because we're currently, if you go to, you know, the wastewater treatment plant, you will see all kinds of algae, you know, species there. But we have to prevent them, you know, going to the river or lake and so on. So, but we still have to do the exact same thing. And we have to ensure that none of that survives, you know, when we discharge them. So, thank you.
I think we're going to have two more questions, and then we're going to have to wrap this up. This is so fascinating. I think it's hard for people not to ask questions. Representative Knuth.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Professor Roon. I want to shift a little bit from the pure science of this to how we make it happen in Minnesota relatively quickly. I mean, we're looking at billions of dollars of investment in our wastewater infrastructure systems in the next decade. We're struggling with that in the bonding bill this year. We will continue to. And so I'm interested first in the time scale, but I'm also interested in not just capturing that economic development in our own wastewater, but in things like patents and bringing this to scale to other places and growing jobs in Minnesota that we can have by sending technologies other places. And, you know, the biofuels from corn being an example. We have the feedstocks and we have the plants, but from the people I've talked to in the industry, a lot of the intellectual property is going to the coasts where the venture capital is. And so from your knowledge, and I know you're more of a scientist, what time scale are we looking at this to be able to put it into wastewater infrastructure that we're having to fix in the next decade? And also, where's our competition in terms of developing these patents and processes and species that you see both nationally and internationally?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative. This is certainly an important issue for us too. the timing and also the intellectual property. And right now, first of all, intellectual property, we did file the patent already with our efficient, you know, light administration, you know, efficient these photobioreactor systems that we already filed with the University of Minnesota. So of course, University of Minnesota will be able to own this technology. And you know, and as far as the timing wise, you know, without all those programs that I talked about national wise, I would say in within certainly 5 years, you will see major scale of these kind of, you know, pilot scale demonstrations. And within 10 years, you will see, if again those are successful, you will see major production scales of this algae as an energy crop and algae as a wastewater treatment kind of tools. So within 10 years, you will see a lot of that kind of plants, just like ethanol plants, just like, you know, biodiesel, you know, soy biodiesel plants and so on. So that's, you know, I'm pretty confident within 10 years you will see that. But whether we can actually be sooner than that or not depends on a few things. First of all, depends on, again, of course, funding. And of course, depends on, you know, how much, how many other programs are involved, how many other companies are involved, how many, you know, people actually we can motivate to actually work in this area. Right now, as I mentioned, you know, it's sort of a lot of faculty interested in this. And then again, at DARPA, they are extremely interested in this. They are talking about, you know, major investment to hopefully move this faster, you know, working, you know, with the companies and so on. And that's another thing that we feel like in order to move this faster is, again, combine our technology, you know, with the state of art industry technology, so that to have industry involvement so that we can move this much quicker. But of course, you know, we still have a lot of things to do. That's the reason we work with, you know, again, MCES to try to, again, you know, develop all these, you know, different scale systems to try to develop our own technology, to try to protect our own technology, and at the same time, you know, move to commercialization as soon as possible. So, thank you.
Did you have a follow-up?
Just one quick follow-up, Madam Chair. In terms of the public-private partnerships and research, I'm not quite sure how to ask this because I don't quite know how it works, but I'm interested in how we leverage private research dollars to complement our public research funding, and how, to what level you've found, and you said, you know, you mentioned a few companies, but have they been significant partners to this point?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, they have indicated, you know, a lot of interest. For example, you know, right now we have, you know, a total of about $80,000 from, you know, MCES and, you know, Minnesota Initiative for Renewable Energy and Environment. And we also have $150,000 from Xcel Energy. They are interested in this. And then again, we have these Donaldson companies that we met just a few days ago. You know, they're interested in helping us to harvesting, and also 3M company, they're interested in the light administration and so on. And the idea is if they can work with us, I mean, because this university developed technology, so we'll, you know, this technology will be owned by the university, but they will have the, you know, first right of refusal of licensing this technology or utilizing this technology or helping us commercialize this technology and so on. So, but these, again, you know, we of course spend quite a bit of, you know, a lot of other, you know, funding from Center for Refining and so on, from other gift fundings on this. But right now we still don't have a major program on this. That's the idea. Hopefully we have major funding, you know, to have a major program so we can continue to maintain our leadership in this area in the nation. So, thank you.
One question I have is, you were going to use the Met Council wastewater stream. We have various, they're not uniform streams across the state. Would it be helpful to be doing the same kind of project on a different kind of wastewater stream at the same time, so that we are looking at more than one at a time, rather than serially looking at a multiply, because we have so many different kinds of wastewater systems, or, you know, effluent is different.
Good question. Thank you, Madam Chair Lavinas. Yes, that's the reason we are actually also looking at, hopefully, you know, different wastewater streams, you know, including the metro pond, and also, you know, Metro Transit Environment Service also have plants in rosemary area, for example. And for a larger plant, it's usually okay because their wastewater compositions are quite uniform. Actually, what we measured here and what we obtained from the literature from other cities in different countries, different part of country, or even international different cities, they are, you know, quite similar because so large amount of wastewater, are mixed together, so they're quite any, uniform. But then again, for the small streams, especially when you have some kind of processing, or industries, or, locally, then you probably have different kind of competition. Then it is important to look at those, and then looking at different species, looking at different conditions, looking at whether those species will be tolerable to that kind of condition and so on. So that is a good point. That is what we hope, again, to expand in different kinds of, pilot testings and so on. So, thank you.
Well, thank you so much for coming. I think this has been fascinating, and I think members have found this fascinating and important.
Thank you very
thank
much.
You.
Thank
you. Thank you. We have now Dr. Timothy Laparta, and I think you're bringing Bill Arnold with you. Welcome to the committee. Why don't you give your names for the record, and thank you for coming.
Madam Chair, committee, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak. My name is Tim LaPera. I'm an associate professor at the University of Minnesota in the Department of Civil Engineering.
I'm Bill Arnold. I'm also an associate professor in the Department of Civil Engineering at the University of Minnesota.
Okay. So we've been asked to talk about our project that was recently funded by the Legislative Citizens Commission on Minnesota Resources. We were also asked to talk about endocrine disrupting compounds, and our project deals with endocrine disrupting compounds to an extent, although not necessarily directly. So we're going to kind of talk about a lot of things. Our project involves issues in microbiology and chemistry, and for any of you who ever liked one part of science and disliked another, that's probably the case with the two of us. So I'm the microbiologist and the two-headed monster, and Dr. Arnold is the chemist. So if you have questions, we might bounce back and forth.
So I get to start all of this. We heard about this a bit earlier, but this is a brief summary of the route to pharmaceuticals to the environment. They're often pill or liquid form, and they're taken by humans and then excreted either in the urine or the feces. From there, they go into the wastewater treatment plant down the toilet. We heard before there's also disposal of pharmaceuticals down the toilet. Obviously, that's unused medication. Once that happens, it goes to the wastewater treatment plant, and in most cases, the wastewater treatment plant discharges into streams or rivers or other surface waters. The other possibility, of course, is the use of pharmaceutical compounds in agriculture or animal husbandry. There, the route is a little more direct because the animal's waste usually doesn't go through a wastewater treatment plant. It could go through a holding pond or something like that, but then there's that same discharge, the leakage out of the ponds, runoff off of the surfaces. during rainstorms. One other possibility here, of course, that isn't shown in this slide, is that the water part of wastewater treatment is also the solids part. So either animal solids or human solids are digested, treated, and now turned into fertilizer. And that process may not remove all the pharmaceuticals, so you may apply the stuff that is fertilizer, then it rains, and it leaches out and winds up in the surface waters that way as well. Why is this important? This is one example that was done in a study in Denver and Boulder, Colorado. I apologize that it's rather small. But this was looking at endocrine disruption or feminization of fish upstream and downstream of the wastewater treatment plant. So they looked at a couple of different wastewater treatment plants, and the numbers here for one of the cases, upstream of Boulder, Colorado's wastewater treatment plant, they harvested some fish. They had 18 females, 14 males, and no intersex fish. Downstream of the wastewater treatment plant, they have 49 females, 5 males, and 4 intersex fish. So the sex ratio has changed dramatically, and intersex fish aren't something that are supposed to be there at all. So what are some of these wastewater-derived pollutants? As we heard before, there are hundreds, if not thousands of them. These are data from a USGS, or these are a few of them were found by a USGS survey about 5 years ago. And they found 95 different compounds. Here are these compounds, what they might do, what they're supposed to do and what they might do in the environment. Triclosan is the antimicrobial compound found in hand soap. So if your hand soap says it's antibacterial, it's got triclosan in it. It's actually at milligrams per milliliter level. Recent research has suggested that triclosan has some estrogenic properties. It's also something that's supposed to kill bacteria, and so there's the potential to develop antibiotic-resistant bacteria when they're exposed to triclosan. Sulfamethoxazole is also an antibacterial. It's a prescription drug, often used for urinary tract infections. Found, again, in wastewater and in river water, so there's a resistance concern here. The next four are all different kinds of estrogenic compounds. Fluoxetine is also known as Prozac, which you might not think of being an estrogenic compound. It does affect, obviously, hormonal levels and excretions and uptakes of transmitters in humans, very widely used. And there's been a number of studies that have suggested that freshwater mussels respond to Prozac. It makes them all happy, and they tend to spawn when they're not supposed to. And it's been suggested that some levels may lead to the extinction of freshwater mussels. 17-alpha ethinylestradiol is the hormone in birth control pills, so obviously a very potent chemical and estrogenic. Bisphenol A is the plasticizer used in polycarbonate bottles, so the nice clean water bottle there has bisphenol A in it to make it the structure that it is. And nonylphenol is a detergent metabolite. So the triclosan, ethinylestradiol, bisphenol A, and nonylphenol, they have some chemical similarities to them. That's why they're all estrogenic. Now, these compounds are removed in wastewater treatment. Anywhere, not these specific ones, but the range of pharmaceuticals, anywhere from 2% of the influent gets removed to 98% is removed. Now, the example for 98% would be ibuprofen or Advil. So it's something that's readily removed in wastewater treatment plants, but so much of it is used, and that is called vitamin I, because so many people take it, that even if only 2% of it gets out, that's still a significant mass. For other ones that only have a 2% removed, they may be chemicals that aren't very efficiently removed. They might be very low levels, but they could also be very potent. An example of a chemical that's about 2% removed is a drug called carbamazepine, which is an anti-epileptic drug and has some other uses as well, and it just flies right through the wastewater treatment plant. So what levels are these? So these are all given, these are again from that USGS study, the same set of six compounds. The levels in river water that were observed, and this is just from one study. These are micrograms per liter, or parts per billion. So you have 1 gram of this stuff, you need 1 billion grams of water to make that concentration. So they're very low levels, but it turns out low is a relative number here. We see the values bounce around between 0.01 and about 40 micrograms per liter. Nonylphenol is the highest one. That's the detergent metabolite, obviously has the largest loads. One that I found somewhat surprising was the 17-alpha-ethinylestradiol, where the high level was 0.8 micrograms per liter, or 0.8 parts per billion, which would be 800 parts per trillion. Again, it sounds like a very small number, but it turns out that 1 part per trillion of some estrogens is enough to cause hormonal disruption in fish. So you're 800 times above that level. So these seem like small numbers, but they tend to have very large impacts. These are river water levels, and so levels in wastewater can be orders of magnitude higher. For example, there's a recent study that showed the fluoxetine level of Prozac to be about 0.5 micrograms per liter. And that's, so in Minnesota we're lucky that we have wastewater that's discharged into surface waters, and we have lots of surface water, so we get some dilution. If you're in California, where some of the streams in the summertime are 100% wastewater, what's in the wastewater is what's in the river. Okay, so the other aspect of our project is to look at antibiotic resistance. I guess the point of emphasis when I teach wastewater treatment design is, what are we treating? And it's literally everything that goes down the toilet. And so a lot of us in the Twin Cities or everywhere are taking antibiotics, and the act of defecation is actually shedding your microflora out of your gastrointestinal tract. So when you take an antibiotic, you're going to be shedding resistant bacteria that were selected in your body. So this becomes, in our view, a very important wastewater treatment issue, although it's not quite there yet. Antibiotic resistance in general is a problem that has been developing literally since the invention of, or discovery of antibiotics. The first thing, the second discovery was that you could find resistant bacteria after we found bacteria that, or after we found the drugs that would kill bacteria. Where we are today is that our first-line antibiotics are becoming increasingly less effective, and that there are some bacterial infections that are no longer treatable. The most infamous of various infections is methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus, MRSA or MRSA. MRSA you can contract from your gym towels. I think somewhere about 20 to 25% of all people just have Staphylococcus aureus hanging around your skin. It's a common skin organism, so we have a lot of Staphylococcus aureus in this room. And it is when they become methicillin-resistant and they become pathogenic, they become deadly, and MRSA is now a bigger killer in the U.S. than AIDS or HIV. So just to talk a little bit more about what's in sewage, there are a lot of microbiologicals in sewage that are of concern. To give a little bit of definition, pathogens are things that make us sick. Those are microorganisms that will make us sick. They're obviously in sewage, okay? So again, when we defecate, we're going to be releasing pathogens. Similar to that, but slightly different, is that antibiotic-resistant bacteria will also be in sewage. It becomes a subtle issue. Pathogens make us sick. Antibiotic-resistant pathogens are even worse, but there are antibiotic-resistant bacteria that won't make us sick. But because bacteria can literally mate and exchange your genetic material, that we can take a benign antibiotic-resistant bacterium and it can mate with a pathogen and make that pathogen resistant. So all bacteria that are resistant to antibiotics are of concern. Of course, the worst ones are the pathogens that are antibiotic-resistant. Okay, so I was pleased to hear earlier that you all have, or many of you have taken field trips to wastewater treatment facilities. For those of us who have dedicated our entire careers to this, that's just fantastic. This is a slide that I teach from for the first day of wastewater treatment, and this is sort of just a general schematic of wastewater treatment processes for relatively large municipalities. And of course, wastewater treatment plants are like children, they're all very different. But this is sort of a general schematic. Basically, we'll have a bar rack, which is exactly like what it sounds. That's going to remove large things that get flushed. Okay? When I say large, bigger than maybe that size, a couple inches. And then we'll have a grit chamber that will remove some of the gritty standing material that is inevitable in sewage. This was discussed a little bit earlier. We'll have what's called primary treatment, which is basically a settling chamber. Let whatever particles that'll settle, and some of them will float also, let those just settle out, and then we can skim those solids off the top. Those solids will be collected, and I'll talk about that in just a second. The water that passes through the primary clarifier has pollution in it that we want to remove, and that's essentially sent to an aeration tank where microorganisms love those nutrients that are left in the wastewater. You give them a little bit of air, and to them it's like eating cheeseburgers or tofu if you're vegetarian. And then we use a secondary clarifier to remove those organisms from the wastewater. Okay, so then we just let them settle out. And then we have
actually quite clean water, usually, and especially in Minnesota, we have quite clean wastewater, that we will then disinfect to inactivate many of the pathogens or other microbiologicals that might be of concern, and then we'll send it off to the world. The other issue of concern is the solids that are collected, and of course, some of the bacteria that grow, well, they're growing, so we'll have to take away the excess, and we'll combine those with the solids from the primary clarifier, and we'll have to treat those solids as well. Okay. As far as microbiological or chemical contaminants of concern, there's really sort of the two discharge points that would concern us. One is the discharge stream, and the other is the solids that we have to treat and then dispose. So I thought I'd talk a little bit about the design goals of a municipal wastewater treatment plant. When I teach this to undergraduates, I really only talk about this thing called BOD. You guys probably heard that before, maybe. It's just an analytical biochemistry term, biodegradable organic carbon, or biochemical oxygen demand. And it's basically a quantity of cheeseburgers for bacteria. How much of this will they eat? And, you know, so as we eat cheeseburgers, we breathe our air. And it's related, actually, to the amount of air that they would breathe, that they need to breathe to eat all those cheeseburgers. Okay? That's important because if this stuff ends out into, say, the Mississippi River, we want to keep oxygen levels high in the river. And let's say the wastewater skipped the treatment plant, went out into the river. The river, the organisms in the river would eat the cheeseburgers and take away all the oxygen. And then you have no oxygen in the river, all the fish would die and it would stink. So that's a big problem. The last talk, last presentation, talked a little bit about nitrogen and phosphorus as pollutants. And we're getting into those as pollutants in the wastewater treatment field, and those are also of concern. Okay, those some plants do and some don't. Most in Minnesota do, I think, to some extent. One, either nitrogen or phosphorus, or sometimes both. There's also some effluent disinfection, and that's to protect us basically from accidental exposure to pathogens in the surface water. How many of you would ever go out to a lake, perhaps not in the boundary waters, and drink the water straight from the surface? Nobody does. But you might do it accidentally if you're skiing and you slip and fall and bounce 3 times. And I know I've done that. So we provide some disinfection for some protection on public health, but it's really quite limited. And then as far as sludge treatment goes, we're really worried about two things. One is pathogens. We know that most of the pathogens in wastewater are going to end up in the sludge treatment. And the second is what we call vector attraction. Sewage sludge tends to attract things that we think of as gross. And the reason why we think they're gross is they spread disease, and so it's a vector. Mathematically, a vector is an arrow, and so it's a way of taking disease as an arrow and shooting it elsewhere. And these are things like rats and birds and other nests. The point I'm trying to make is that wastewater treatment plants are not intentionally designed to remove some of these trace contaminants like pharmaceuticals. So it doesn't mean they can't do that also, but they're not intentionally designed to do that. And so the challenge really is to come up with an economically feasible way to remove these contaminants also. So our project is really to look at some of alternative process designs to help with these problems. One of our ideas that we're actually pursuing directly is to photodegrade some of these pharmaceutical compounds via passive or an engineered, more active solar disinfection system. As far as removing some of the particles from wastewater, that would remove a lot of the pathogens or other microbiologicals that would be worried about. We could do that through some means of effluent filtration, either a sand filtration method or a membrane filtration method. These are pretty uncommon in the wastewater treatment field. The Western Lakes Superior Sanitary District process up in Duluth, they use a sand filter. They're kind of rare. These are fairly expensive, so they're not widely used at this point. There are a number of advanced oxidation processes. These primarily involve chemistry, so I'll let Professor Arnold talk about those. And then there's the sludge digesters, and there are a million versions of those, it seems. Also, our process, our research is really focused on two variables. One is, do we give the digesters oxygen
so that the bacteria can breathe like oxygen, like we breathe oxygen, or do we not give them oxygen so they can go through some other metabolic processes? And how does that affect the degradation of some of these pharmaceutical compounds? And then the other variable is temperature. You guys obviously know that if you raise the temperature, you can disinfect things. This is why you would boil water, for example. So we're looking at aerobic versus anaerobic, and then temperature as our big question. Okay. So to talk about the oxidation processes, basically the advanced oxidation processes involve rather large capital investments and then large operating costs. So, for example, ozonating all the wastewater is very expensive. So our idea was to use something more passive, such as solar treatment. Turns out that a lot of pharmaceuticals are sensitive to light. And this is why when you get the drugs from the drugstore, they say store it in a cool, dark place in a nice little plastic bottle. Or if you're on certain kinds of medications, it's recommended you wear sunscreen. So it turns out your skin is translucent to the right wavelength of light, and the drugs can get photoactivated in your bloodstream and cause an enhanced sunburn. So the essential idea here is demonstrated here, where you have the water in some system and the light shines on it, and after some period of time it is no longer that chemical, and hopefully whatever biological activity it has been removed. So a passive solar treatment system, we have some places in Minnesota where this might actually already be occurring. For those of you who toured the Shakopee Wastewater Treatment Plant, which is Blue Lake, this is the Google image of that plant. It turns out, at least when I took the tour several years ago, they told me that big dark rectangle there is the pond. And it used to be, that used to be the wastewater treatment plant. You stored the water in the pond, and then every once in a while you discharged it. And then the metro area got too big, and they built an activated sludge plant on front of it. The interesting thing is they kept the pond, and that's kind of unusual for an activated sludge plant. So here there's some extra period of time where the water is held there, and light shines on it during the day, and obviously more in the summer than in the winter. But one of the goals of the project is to see if we're getting any additional removal of pharmaceutical compounds and antibiotic-resistant bacteria during the autolysis time, because it turns out you can also do solar disinfection. They all say sunlight is the best disinfectant, right? And so we're going to try and measure that in the laboratory and then a small pilot scale system. This is, I think the next slide is just another picture of the same thing. It's a rather large pond, so there should be some significant time here. And this thing in the foreground here is the next step of disinfection that they do seasonally. You can also do active solar treatment, and this is actually a picture I stole off the web, so I can't take credit for the nice little animation, but it's actually a solar water heater. And basically you have a solar collector that focuses light on the tube, and the other question we have is, do we get enhanced disinfection and enhanced chemical destruction if we can focus the light in the system? The advantages are we can get heat. Heat may accelerate the chemical processes. It should accelerate the disinfecting processes as well. The problem is here you have materials that you need to use. And if you have glass, obviously you transmit more light, but it's also fragile. You also hold more heat depending on the insulating quality of your material. More commonly, you use something like polycarbonate for this, which of course has the problem that it's got bisphenol A in it, but that's another issue altogether. But the polycarbonate filters certain wavelengths of light, and it may not filter the light that does disinfection, but it probably does filter a lot of light that's chemical destruction. So the question is, what are the scaling issues involved here? If we use polycarbonate, which is really good for heat and disinfection, do we prevent chemical destruction? If we use glass, do we have destruction issues where we can't make it large enough? And these are some of the things we're working on right now. Okay, so if you think back to that diagram of the basic schematic of the wastewater treatment plant, where would some of these pharmaceuticals be susceptible to biodegradation? And the most obvious place is in the aeration tank, where it's designed to biodegrade. Virtually every compound that is flushed down the toilet. When you design one of these, the key variable is the mean cell residence time. It's called the sludge retention time, the solid retention time. And basically, the more or the longer the solid residence time is, the better pollutant removal you get. That's the general phenomenon. The problem becomes that next step with separating out the biomass, if you let this solid retention time get too high, the biomass no longer settles. And so that's one of your limiting constraints.
there are plants I've heard elsewhere in the world, I haven't seen one in Minnesota, where they actually keep the solid retention time very low, that prevents oxidation of ammonia, and so it becomes a little bit cheaper for treatment. Most of the plants that I've seen, or actually all the plants I've seen in Minnesota, are operated sort of at the optimum level for pollutant removal efficiency. That residence time is as long as it possibly can before settling becomes compromised. So within Minnesota, I don't think there's a whole lot that can be done to improve that. Bob Polta would probably know. Bob's sort of a guy I talk to a lot. There probably are a few plants here and there where that could be improved, but by and large, most of our plants in Minnesota are really quite good. The other possibility are bioregulation of these compounds within the sludge, and a lot of them will go with the sludge. Many compounds degrade only aerobically, many degrade only anaerobically. Specifically in mind here, it seems that the estrogenic compounds seem to biodegrade aerobically, not anaerobically, which is of concern because the standard technology for sludge digestion is actually at about body temperature, which become relevant in just a moment, and without oxygen, so anaerobically. So in two words, we're doing it wrong. The elevated temperatures that we could use for wastewater treatment or for sludge digestion should kill bacteria of concern. There's some pasteurization effect, essentially. A few plants within Minnesota do this. It's not common. The one that I know of for sure is up in Duluth, the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, where they operate their digesters at about 135 to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. This is well above our body temperature, so most of the organisms that can make us sick will be killed by the temperatures. And it's never made sense to me, but most of our digesters are operated at about our body temperature. So there is some wiggle room for optimizing these processes, and that's really what our research is about as far as sludge digestion. We want to optimize disinfection. We want to optimize degradation of these pharmaceutical compounds. So to wrap things up, just to give you an update on our progress, we started on July 1st. Our graduate students came September 1st. So our graduate students have taken some classes. And then we've started to get them into the laboratory. Professor Arnold's student has started testing some of the materials to set up his photo degradation experiment. And my student has ordered a large number of lab-scale sludge digesters. And we're in the process of setting those up right now.
So, Representative
Hunter. Well, it made up a good question of mine. If we could get a free or very inexpensive source of heat, would it pay to heat above, you know, you say above body temperature, and you said Northwest Sanitary District is at 137 degrees. How about 160 degrees? 150 degrees. Would that make the effluent from sewage treatment safer?
Madam Chair, Representative, that's an excellent question. The issue is where is the source of heat? I'm going to ask a question and answer it. One might ask why these are called digesters. They're actually the microbial activity is actually modeled after our digestion process.
Mm-hmm.
And let's see. I'm trying to put this. Now I'll put it crudely. There's a reason why frat boys like their flatulence. It generates methane. And so what occurs with these anaerobic digesters is they generate methane, and that's the fuel source to actually heat the digester. Okay. When they run anaerobically. Aerobically is a little bit more complicated. So there's a limit to how high we can economically treat them. The other plant that I know of that's interested in this, a friend of mine, Dr. Mark Knopf, is the Director of Public Works for Faribault, and he's considering going to one of these high-temperature one processes because he thinks they generate more methane. There's not a lot of them used in the U.S., and so it's a little bit questionable, and whenever you're doing something different, it's a little bit more complicated. But I think they would work. As far as killing organisms, I think it would be great. Whether or not it's economical, it probably wouldn't but I think 140 degrees Fahrenheit is probably hot enough. But hopefully we'll find that out with our study. We really should. Yes. Can I add one thing, Tim? That's for the solids part. For the water, you can only heat it so high, because if you discharge water that's too hot, you have, well, not only steam, but you have bad impacts on the bio, the fish and everything else in the river. So, yeah, to follow that, I guess, Madam Chair and Representative, the number that's shown in the presentation previous to us was 185 million gallons a day leaves the Metropolitan Wastewater Treatment Plant in St. Paul. That's not economically feasible to heat that at all. That's a lot of water.
So the thing we were just mentioning to each other up here is Minnesota has always thought we have, you know, just an abundance of water all over the place. And we're coming to find out that that's not true. And we're also using immense amounts of water to make ethanol, and folks are talking about using lots and lots more. So the question is there a way to heat the water and have a beneficial use at the same time? And have you all been talking about that at all?
I'm chair, members of the committee. Certainly with the solar heating, you're not going to raise the temperature too much, and it depends on the pumping costs and things like that. It may be just small enough that if you have a moderate-sized treatment plant, you could use the water to heat the treatment plant where the people are working. For a lot of the solar things, it's going to have to be small-scale treatment communities. I mean, it's not going to be feasible at the metro plant to use solar treatment. The land area you would need to build a pond is too large in there. It's going to have to be very local to where the heat is needed, obviously. And for the digesters, I'll turn it that way.
Yeah, to follow up on that, Madam Chair, both committees. There are probably a lot of creative uses of wastewater and even the solids. Maybe 20, 25 years ago, wastewater solids were generally sent to landfills, and now they're awesome. Let's see, I shouldn't say generally. It would be great, the Water Environment Federation, which is sort of the big professional society related to wastewater treatment and water quality, is really trying to get these onto applied to land as a soil conditioner. Fertilizers, the last presentation certainly shows that there's a lot of nutrient value in sewage, and that we could certainly use that. And there are a number of very creative wastewater reuse. The extreme case is you treat it to the point where it's potable and then you drink it. But there are a lot of uses of water not in the drinking water sense, that don't require it be safe to drink. So that would just require a lot of creativity. Or maybe not even a lot of creativity, just a little bit of creativity. Mm-hmm. A lot of creativity with the last presentation we saw. Mm-hmm. That was just wonderful.
Sure. Representative Cruz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think, Dr. LaPara, this is probably better for you, but I'm really interested in a little more information about triclosan, that we're washing our hands constantly in something that's creating bacterial resistance, but I didn't really know it has estrogenic properties as well. And are there any specific studies about the levels and how this has gone up and any impacts? Do you have anyone studying it?
Okay. There have been several studies on the estrogen and androgen activity of triclosan, and it's usually just with model fish systems. And the levels are relatively high, just because the chemical functional group in triclosan that makes an estrogen, it's there, but it's not in quite the right form as it is compared to estradiol or something like that. So I think it's an emerging concern with triclosan, although the antibacterial resistance one is a larger one.
To follow that up, Madam Chair and Representative, just to point out that there is no known reason why triclosan is in soap, just so y'all know. Talking to the folks at Procter & Gamble, Professor Arnold is truly the expert on this, but the folks at Procter & Gamble say they do it because everybody else is doing it. That was a direct quote that the guy wishes to remain anonymous. There is some thought that in underdeveloped countries where people might bathe once a week, once a month, that there could be some benefits. But in the U.S., where our in the U.S., where our hygiene is, the personal hygiene is much better, there's no purpose for it other than marketing.
Madam Chair, I just have to comment. I don't know, Representative Coons, I'm sure you weren't elected then. It was like maybe 3 years ago where I had a group of 11-year-old Girl Scouts from my Senate district that I work with that basically did the research and documented that fact about antibacterial soap, and they brought a bill to me to ban them. And I was able to get an informational hearing on that bill in the Senate Commerce Committee. And in this informational hearing where no vote would be taken, three soap lobbyists flew in from Washington, D.C. to testify against the 11-year-old girls out of fear that we would expose the truth that you've just stated. So I just wanted to point that out. They did get national media, the Girl Scouts did, so they kind of got the upper hand in the end anyway.
Representative Carlson.
I'm tempted to ask any of you in the audience to help him.
Yeah, really. Let's bring them up. They're all in.
That person from Procter & Gamble promotes the product. That's for their home office effect. But my true question, though, was related to this in terms of source reduction. And, you know, what comes to my mind when you talk about flushing would be unused medications in hospitals, nursing homes, various clinics. The soap, which obviously would be a big one, but I would think if we could do more on the source reduction side, that would relieve some of it on the treatment side. And just one anecdotal before, I think it was probably Dr. Reynolds, but not too long ago, Paul Peters, some of my mother passed away, and we had some pretty high potent meds because she was in a home hospice care, and we were told by the hospice people to simply flush those meds with a witness down the toilet to show that they had been disposed of, and that was the direction that was given to us in case we had any extra meds. I'm talking about the morphine and so on that she was using in the last few days. So what is being done on the source reduction side? What kind of impact would that have?
You can go first. Madam Chair, one of the presentations earlier, they mentioned that if we just didn't flush it, it would be much easier. And that's not a statement I agree with. This is a very difficult problem that needs to be addressed. First of all, it's going to create a solid waste problem. Okay. So, and that's probably addressable. And Professor Arnold can probably tell you better than I can on that. And if we collect the drugs, and then we can probably incinerate them or do something else with them. But this becomes a really big issue as far as how do you collect the drugs. Now, you mentioned one, first of all, that these are controlled substances. And so you had to have a witness. So let's say they're collected. Now you have collectors that you have to worry about to make sure it's all done correctly. And then there are privacy issues. Let's say you don't want to reveal that you have morphine at your home. And so it becomes a very difficult problem that I don't know what people are doing in Minnesota. I went to a solid and hazardous waste conference, and that was a big topic. And there are lots of programs throughout the country, and it was actually really quite comical that one, they basically set this up right next to the gun buyback program, because that was the level of security that you had to have. Okay. So, Professor Elm, do you want to...
Yeah, Madam Chair's representative, I can add a couple of anecdotes. One is that Duluth did something like this recently where they had a one-day... rather than having people flushing down the toilet, it said, bring your drugs to us, and we'll dispose of them by incineration for that. And the amazing thing is they got 250 pounds of drugs in an 8-hour period. It doesn't sound like it, but it's in a little pill bottle. So that's a lot of material that you can get in one day. So that people were aware of the issue and willing to turn in their drugs that way. There are other issues. So a lot of expired medications from pharmacies, they all go to Chicago. And it's a big incinerator where they do that. So there's been suggestions that you would take them back to the pharmacy because there's already privacy issues there. But then there's another level of stuff going back there as well. The other thing they do with it is they sell it to the third world when they're expired. But I think the big issue there, one way to do it is education and public education and outreach programs such as the one we heard about earlier for on-site sewage treatment. You had similar ones for pharmaceutical disposal that may be very useful as well. And I did actually hear that we heard about the nursing earlier where they were popped and flushed down the toilet. There are nursing programs now that are starting to teach them not to do that. And so I think that mindset is starting to change, but it's going to take more education to get there.
Yeah. And then, sure, I raised that question with somebody the other day, and they said that there is a change, at least in the hospital end of it, where they're now getting other directions, like supposed to collect or whatever they do. But I think that.
Do you have a question?
No.
I don't see any other questions, but I did want to mention that when I was talking about beneficial reuse of wastewater, it was not of the floods, which we've talked about historically, but actually of the water. Mm-hmm. And here we have this huge demand for the water in ethanol plants. And are there possibilities there where we have ethanol plants that have been sited and used the groundwater and then had to move to the river because they didn't have enough groundwater? And we have other, I would say, controversial plants coming, asking for permits where the neighbors are saying, no, you're taking too much of our drinking water. So the question is, and I can give you a good example of that, the IEP. The Iota plant, where the neighbors have formed a group, and I know about it because they keep, you know, they're extremely interested in talking about this. But it does seem the heat, the beneficial use of water, there are possibilities that I hope you all will think about as you're working on this project, because it's an important one for Minnesota.
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is a comment. I mean, I agree with you entirely. And one of the things, it becomes a real cultural issue for how we as Minnesotans live and actually Americans live. One of the curious things that we do is we treat all of our, this isn't even a wastewater issue, we treat all of our drinking water to the point where it's potable. But how much water do we actually, when we flip the faucet on, do we actually drink? It's actually a relatively small amount. There are lots of things we could do. I don't think we're going to be able to address many of those at the research side, but certainly, when I say we, I mean Professor Arnold and I. Others of us can, certainly. Professor Ruan, actually, I was amazed. But, yeah.
Well, we weren't asking you to add to your research project. Oh, rather to just think about this, what I see as a, and I think a lot of other folks see as an emerging issue in Minnesota. Thank you. We really appreciate your coming and helping us understand all of these things that we need to understand.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Next, we have the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and we have an agenda out, but they would like to change the order of presenters, which is, of course, just fine. And we have Mike Sandusky, who's coming up first.
Good afternoon. So is it Madam Chair, or is it Madam Chair? I'm sorry.
Chairing. She's okay. Chairing today. I'll chair the next time.
Just wanted to be sure.
Just go with the normal. I think that'll work.
Madam Chair and committee members, Mike Sandusky.
Next time, by the way, folks, will be on Friday. Next time is on Friday. That's right.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Mike Sandusky, Director of Environmental Analysis and Outcomes Division at the Pollution Control Agency, and we actually touched on this subject a little bit in November. Last time I was here. A couple of precedent comments, perhaps, and I love following
forum following, because you just had the experts currently as they exist on wastewater treatment technology for endocrine disrupting compounds. One of the preceding comments is just a reminder. Next week, on time, you will be delivered a report mandated by last session, which will do a number of things. I'm not going to go into great detail, but will serve you, I think, as a building block in addition to all the testimony you've heard. And one of the things it will do that I don't intend to cover today, because I'm not an expert, actually, is the effects portion of endocrine disruptors. It's also going to provide some organization, classification, to the discussion about all of these compounds. Even, point in reference, even the last commenters, we're really talking about principally pharmaceutical. There are other classes of endocrine disrupting compounds that may or may not be addressed in their research. So it's big, it's broad, it's complicated. I want to remind you of that. And the effects, just to touch on this a little bit, you know, there is research, and some of it's been discussed in this committee over the last couple of years anyway, that goes to the cellular level, the tissue level, the individual organism level, and even population level. So it's a very, very complicated subject area. The other thing I'm going to reference is that in that report you will receive next week, although it wasn't a big focus of what the legislature wanted, there will be a short, very general treatise on wastewater treatment technology and a little bit on cost. So I'm not really going to talk about that today, but you'll be getting that information as well. And with that, I thought what I could provide today as a different building block, something that maybe you haven't touched on too much, is really the regulatory landscape. And this is a fairly draconian sort of, in my point of view, sort of draconian point of view, about the regulation aspects of wastewater treatment and endocrine disrupting compounds. I want to do three things. I want to talk to you about some of the efforts that are being made nationally by EPA and the FDA, actually. I want to talk specifically about some of the efforts being made by EPA on the development of water quality criteria for endocrine disrupting compounds. I'll make a summary statement about the overwhelming challenge that exists there, even for EPA, with no political shading. And finally, I want to skim through, you've heard some of this before, but I want to talk about the tie-in with the agency and what we're doing. In fact, at the national level, EPA for several years has had an endocrine disruptor screening program, and actually mandated pursuant to requirements by FDA and others. It's got three objectives. One is to prioritize chemicals for screening for potential for endocrine effects. To develop, and this is very important, to develop assays, tests, my former life, for trying to understand and define toxic endpoints related to these disrupting chemicals, and set in place a whole slew of policy and procedures for dictating how this whole process would unfold. To date, I'm going to talk about two aspects of their program. To date, under the aspect of the assays and the testing development, several assays have been developed, but validation of those assays has occurred for only a few, i.e., they are behind. In terms of prioritizing chemicals for purposes of screening, they are behind there as well, but current information, actually open for public comment, are 73 pesticides that are open right now in the Federal Register for anticipating requiring screening. And those are, I think the comment period closes next month, in fact. Other important efforts going on, not related directly to water quality criteria, but related to
determining, getting through a slew, hundreds, perhaps thousands, I'm the third person to say that today, of these chemicals that have the potential or might have the potential for endocrine disruption. They're looking at something called HEPA, HTPS. It's a high throughput screening system in order to deal with a number, it's already used in industry, but it's with a huge number of chemicals that need to be screened for their potential. And at the moment, this tool, I will call it a tool, this tool isn't quite to the ready for regulatory use yet, but they're working on it. They also are working on a model, shorthand is QSAR, I guess QUASAR if you want, which is quantitative structure activity relationship. This is fascinating to me as a biologist because what it pretends to do is, I think you've heard this before from Heiko Schoenfuss and others, Dr. Swackhammer from the U and others, with the endocrine system, we're really talking about receptor sites. And so what this model attempts to do, and it has, you know, I'm hopeful it can do a lot of prediction, accurate prediction. What it intends to do is it looks at chemical structure, and it will predict the interference or interaction with receptor sites related to the endocrine system. So it's a good tool for dealing with large numbers of compounds and the expense that needs to go, you know, if you're going to take it through assay testing that would be associated with all that. So to screen some of those out. And my general comment about this phase of EPA's work is that they are behind. But I'm going to make another comment about that in a moment. EPA's work on water quality criteria. Real quickly, a primer water quality criteria. Historically, EPA provides states with delegated programs like ours with water quality criteria that we use in a process that that probably isn't a good subject for today, but we use to then develop water quality standards, which we then use most practically to provide in effluent limitations for discharges in their permits. So there's sort of three steps there. To date, EPA has published one water quality criteria for an endocrine disruptor, nonylphenol, which was referenced before. The unfortunate thing about that water quality criteria is that the endpoint for the disrupting activity related to aquatic wildlife didn't come along with that criteria. So its practicality for use as a standard is not really there quite yet. They are working on ethanol estradiol, which was referenced before, EE2 from birth control pills, been referenced before. They're working on trenbolone, which is a cattle growth hormone. And they're working on triclosan, which was also previously discussed. But none of these have actually gotten to the stage where they can be used by state regulatory agencies for developing water quality standards. And the comment about that, and I don't want to sound whiny, but so be it if I do. Historically, as I said before, EPA takes the first step, and the first step is very important. It's the gathering of all of the research, actually paying for the conducting of testing specific to the compound in question, to look at toxic endpoints and effects, and then gathering all this data and providing a water quality criteria for states to use. Well, with hundreds and thousands of these chemicals, and with the fact that they haven't made a lot of progress, even though some of these programs have been in place for quite a while, it's sort of an unspoken, not talked about very often burden that the states are going to be facing if, I emphasize if states actually eventually get into the business of providing regulatory standards for specific endocrine disrupting compounds. And that's, in my mind, that's still enough. And I'll talk about that in a second. What is the PCA doing? Well, we have some tangents to previous testimony here, so this is somewhat of a reminder. But number one, we try to stay current with all of this research, of course. And some of it that you have heard over the last couple of years we have collaborated on, so we're partners for some of it.
thanks to this body, we're and I reported on this in November. We're about to launch our three-phased endocrine monitoring study across the state. All of that is going to generate a lot of information that will be used at the federal level or other levels to develop water quality criteria. And if you want me to go into some of the details of our design for that study, I would, but needless to say, it focuses on potential sources, it focuses on statewide monitoring, it focuses on determining effects and ultimately identifying culprits, if you will, specific compounds that are causing the effects. So the study, the monitoring study, is going to be very helpful in all of this. All of this will contribute to the national data set, which I didn't mention specifically a second ago. And then, of course, the state, meaning the PCA in this case, we just finished, this is sort of boring for some of you, I'm pretty sure, but we are mandated by the Clean Water Act to review routinely our water quality standards and rules. We've just finished a round, not quite yet signed by the governor, but we've just finished a round, and I'll give you an example. Within that large effort, we have developed, for example, two standards for pesticides, acetachlor and metolachlor, and we're actually the first in the country for one of those. And I'm only mentioning these because, aside from the controversy that was so much fun to deal with, this is an expensive and time-consuming proposition. So to think about the hundreds or thousands of potential endocrine disruptors is kind of hard for me to think about vision-wise. One last thing I want to leave you with before you have any questions for me is it's been alluded to, you've heard some of this before. I know when Dr. Swackhammer was here in November, she talked about her initial results from looking at both the effluents from both the Metro facility, largest in the state, activated sludge, as well as Western Lake Superior Sanitary District, which has already been referenced today. And the one thing I don't think that was referenced today that was very apparent in her initial research is the fact that Western Lake separated itself from Metro in the following way, probably many ways that are beyond me, but one of them was very significant. It was the fact that phytoestrogens, plant estrogens, were seen at very high levels from Western Lake Superior. And I think she made statements about the contributing sources there, of course, is pulp and paper. And so it doesn't take one long with your head sort of vision to all that's before us in this great state, that all of this biofuels, anytime you're using cellulosic material to produce fuel and energy, these phytoestrogens might be a place to look, and certainly it'll be a place that the agency will be looking relative to our statewide monitoring study. So, any questions for me?
Madam Chair, just on your last point, I remember just hearing about that generally about Well, did you say estrogen or endocrine disruptors generally that were found related to the pulp and paper manufacturing?
Phytoestrogens,
thank
yep.
you. But do you know where, I mean, and making your assumption that this could affect biofuels processing in general, where is it coming from specifically in pulp and paper? Is it a certain chemical that's in use, or do we have any idea?
Madam Chair, Senator, you're beyond my expertise right now. All I know is that there are references in the research literature right now related to biofuels and the generation of similar estrogen-like compounds.
Oh, okay. That's broader.
By the way, I mean, we don't always think of it. This is one of the things thank you for asking a question because I left out something. We think about man-made chemicals, and actually there are a number of biogenic, mm-hmm. natural to the environment
endocrine disrupting, potentially, compounds. And phytoestrogens are just one class of those. These are the growth and maturation hormones that plants use to mature. So we have to be a little more expansive when we think about the sources of some of these endocrine disrupting compounds.
No, go ahead. I think that the question that popped to mind with the Western Lake Superior Sanitary District was that would you be requiring more pretreatment so that that heavy endocrine disruption was not getting into their wastewater treatment system? Because apparently we have a rule that says if you only contribute 5%, then you don't have to pre-treat, and that seems to say, that rule doesn't work.
Madam Chair, well, I'm certainly that rule was not written with EDCs in mind. I think my best response to you, Madam Chair, is that now that we're, at least there's a question here, which was demonstrated in Western Lake's case. There are other places we need to monitor and get data to understand what source of potential there is here. How it fits into the rules that we have currently, that's sort of a side issue for me. I'm a little more interested in, from a surveillance aspect, understanding a little more than we do right now from this one study that the U has conducted related to Western Lakes. So the rest of this that I talked about, except for the references in research to biofuels generation and cellulosic activity, that was a real statement. This is a little bit speculative on my part. I'm talking about where the state needs to look for these types of biogenic EDCs.
Well, it seems to me if monitoring is your issue, are you asking the industry to do the monitoring?
We haven't gotten to that point yet, Madam Chair.
Don't you think it's about time?
Could be, Madam Chair.
I think we will have to have some more chats about the timing here, because if we see this issue, I don't think it's enough to say, well, someday somebody else is going to monitor it. That if this is a significant issue, then we need to do some problem solving. I want to go back to the references to temperature that were made by the folks who testified before you, and it was my understanding that we have a number of plants that use body temperature as the regulatory number, and that may be not the right thing to do anymore. And are we thinking about that?
Madam Chair, I'm looking over in the audience to someone who would be able to respond to that question.
Okay. I mean, it's one thing to say, look at a problem like endocrine disruption and say, well, there's so many of them, and it's going to take a long time to look at every one of them, and I can hear in your talking to us that it's not going to be in my lifetime. So my question is, can we do some prevention just by raising the temperature of the water, even though we don't know exactly how much we're preventing? We certainly will be preventing.
Madam Chair, first off, my name is Wendy Curry. I'm the Municipal Wastewater Manager. First, can I answer another question that Mike just wouldn't know about when you talked about the pretreatment? Our pretreatment rules would allow us, if we knew that it, you know, when we know more, when we can set limits, if we know it's causing a problem, it doesn't have to be 5%. So, you know, we do have rules in place that we could use.
Okay.
In terms of temperature...
Well, let's back up on that then. If we know more, then do your rules allow you to ask folks who are contributing, and when you see an indication and say, uh-oh, can you then say, we need to have that tested every month now from over the course of the next year?
It gets difficult because what our rules basically say, you can't have a pass-through, but we have to say, or you can't have something that's going to cause a problem with the effluent limit. And in this case, we don't have an effluent limit. So until there's really something that says, yes, this is a problem, you know, until we get the additional information that we need to say this is a problem. If once we have that, we can very easily go back then to the industries and say, at least regulatorily, we can do that. Then there's the other problem, you know, what do they do? You know, what are their choices? And, you know, again, that's a whole set of all these other, you know, kind of things that come into concern.
That seems to me like a pretty big chicken and egg issue. You know, if we don't have a standard, well, then we don't have to ask them to monitor, and they won't monitor, so we won't really need to know whether we have a standard.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you know, that is a good question. And I was trying to, as I was sitting here, I was trying to think there's probably cases where we have asked people to monitor for much more specific, you know, if we think there might be a concern, certainly we look at what's at that industry. It's just that this is such, you know, it's so new that, you know, and there's so many different things that they could monitor for, and, the, you know, so we have to, I think we, obviously that's what we'll want to be at some point.
But well, perhaps you could let the committee chairs know and that if you have ever asked an industry to monitor, so we have something put on the table by the University of Minnesota, and that's a credible group. Have you ever asked an industry then to go and monitor or not?
So, Madam Chair, monitor for
anything.
Anything that we don't give them a limit for? Is mm-hmm. that okay? You know, I. Yeah.
If you could check, and yeah. you don't have to tell us now, but if you could check and see if you've ever done that, and then the next question will, of course, be, and if you haven't, then is there something that needs to be addressed?
Right. Madam Chair, I think I can answer that some. We do actually, we don't limit, I'm trying to think of a way to answer it. We don't limit, say, for example, there's this whole list of different organic chemicals that, you know, toluene, benzene, those kinds of things. We don't necessarily put limits in treatment plants because we don't expect that they will exceed them. However, we do require the treatment plants to monitor for them. And we also, if we have an industry that we know that could potentially discharge that parameter, we would require them to monitor it. In this case, again, our big issue, our big area of question is what would our final limit be, or what area, when does it become an area of concern? And I think it's just all evolving, and that's why we don't, you know, we haven't asked for any kind of disruption monitoring.
But I was hearing first that we had to find out if this was a one-time thing, or don't we have to monitor, and that's what Mr. Sandusky was saying to us. We need to monitor. So if that is the case, then shouldn't we be monitoring?
You know, it's a difficult question because I'm not saying we shouldn't be looking at that. It's just, I think it's so new. There's so much information. There's so many. What do we monitor for? And we just, you know, those are some, I think, areas that we're going to have to sort out. Since we get that sorted out, I think then the next logical steps are, what do we have treatment plants monitor for? Which industries do we look at? What do they monitor for? You know, those are the logical next steps. We're just not quite there yet.
It seems to me that as a practical matter, you monitor for what Dr. Schweikamer found.
Madam Chair, let's retract here a little bit. First of all, my references were to the fact that, and I have no appreciation for the types of pulp and paper or cellulosic-related industrial discharges that go to Western Lake versus the potential for other types of cellulosic discharges that go to other wastewater treatment facilities. And my statement was in reference to the fact that with the endocrine disruptor monitoring study starting out this season, we should fairly quickly have a much better idea of what sort of predictive discharges we should have at these types of facilities, which seems to me to be a much better approach. I'm not talking about the monitoring itself, but in terms of getting a handle on where some of these phytoestrogens might be coming from, that seems to be a much better approach than asking everybody to monitor when we're not quite sure exact. I mean, in Western Lake, we know what was found in the effluent, but for some of these others, we're just putting together the notions of cellulosic processes and the potential for some sort of phytoestrogen to be released.
All I was talking about was Western Lake Superior.
Okay.
And Madam Chair, certainly that's something that we're looking at. We're trying to sort out what's the data tell us. And so I don't want to give you the impression that we're not looking at this. We just haven't gotten to that point yet. In terms of the temperature, I guess that was your second question, and you might have to help me with this again. The question that I think I understood you asking was whether or not we could heat our effluent up to those levels, or are we talking about our digestible, the sludge?
So, help me out here.
Mm-hmm.
We heard testimony previously to you saying that the standard we use at our wastewater plants now is body temperature, right?
Madam Chair, correct. For anaerobic first, so that when we take sludge and we put it in this, we want, basically what we're trying to do is take the solids from our treatment facility to settle out, and we're trying to get them to heat off of each other and break it down into a manner that it reduces the pathogens. And yes, we do, most commonly, time and temperature are the two big things that we do. And 98 degrees is the common temperature that we keep an anaerobic digester at.
But with our previous testimony that they were saying, I think it ought to be higher. Now, you may not catch everything, but before we know the optimum temperature, will you be looking at the issue of perhaps what we've done in the past is needs to be changed?
Madam Chair, I'll be honest with you. First time I heard that piece of information was today. Wrote it down. We'll have to look at what it means. Just so you understand, it is really would be treating the sludge, what we land apply. Not that that's not something we should look at, but it certainly does not address the whole effluent, what goes out into the river.
Does anybody else have any questions? And I have one more. I don't see any other questions. One of the things that is clearly emerging in Minnesota is we're having trouble siting ethanol plants because some places there isn't the water, or the folks don't want the drinking water used. Have you all been looking at the beneficial reuse of wastewater?
Madam Chair, a couple things. We do, I don't have the exact numbers, but I know we have, I think, three permits right now where we do have some beneficial reuse. I can recall it's all back onto golf courses, but for irrigation purposes. And we actually have procedures in place. We have people call us fairly regularly asking us about that. I know that the ethanol facilities have looked at reuse of wastewater. Not quite sure. I don't think it hasn't happened today, and I don't know really what all the companies have looked at it. I'm not sure if it's piping that's been the problem or if it's too expensive to, it maybe has to be very, very pure water to use. I'm not sure what the issues are, but I certainly do know that they have looked at it.
Well, of course, everybody would want to use pure water, and I think of my city, well, of course, with my, which is Minneapolis, would love to use pure water and go into the aquifer. If my city did that, we would so quickly deplete the aquifer that we don't do it. We have a treatment system to treat the water before citizens can use it. So I think the analogy is a correct one, that perhaps a ethanol plant that wants to go in an area where there may be a limited amount of water, maybe the alternative to using drinking water, quality water,
Beneficial use. Absolutely. I'm sure that's what they're looking at, and they're going to weigh the cost to get water versus water out of the ground versus the cost it is to treat it to the level that they would want. And I'm aware of at least two, if not three, of the ethanol facilities that are certainly looking at it. Where that's at, I don't know.
The cost to get water out of the ground is so cheap. I mean, it's cost for using water in Minnesota, $3,750 for an ethanol plant per year. That's too cheap. So the price drives them to say, well, let's use drinking water. Don't you think?
Madam Chair, you know, again, that's in terms of water appropriation, you know, water appropriation is really falls under the DNR, whether or not they can get it. And I think they've actually had, and again, I'm speaking for, you know, on sort of what I heard, some difficulties getting water appropriation in some of those areas. So so that's why they are looking at reuse. Also, they've had discharge, you know, difficult to, they have to meet many limits in order to discharge it into rivers. So there is a lot of benefits for them to look at water reuse, and that's certainly what they're doing.
Any other questions from members? Thank you all.
Madam Chair, are you ready for us?
We are. Today we were looking mainly at the standards for wastewater treatment systems and what the emerging science is teaching us and how to kind of practically do some problem solving. But I understand you all wanted also to talk something about the numbers, and that's great. We have one more testifier after you, Lewis Smith, and I apologize for us going so long. However, I think the science coming from you is something that we all needed to learn.
Right.
And probably doesn't hurt any of us.
Yes. Well, actually, Madam Chair, if you want, we can keep our presentation real brief. We provided a book with lots of information in it. Our phone numbers, both mine and Jeff's, are on the bottom. Feel free to give us a call. The governor's capital budget should be out in a couple of weeks. People will know what's in it. We can talk more about it then. If you want to get into the ranking criteria, we did put in that booklet, there's the first brown page right after the Clean Water Project list, talk about the ranking criteria, and I can let Jeff and Bill Dunn cover that, and we can talk about financing wastewater treatment at a later date. I just, if I want to emphasize anything, we do try to coordinate with all the funding agencies, everybody that I'm aware of, Corps of Engineers, USDA Rural Development, the Department of Trade and Economic Development asked us to administer the Small City Development Program, which are HUD funds. We all use the project priority list when it comes to wastewater from CCA, trying to find the best projects, knowing each has different criteria. You know, some can address small communities, some have to address low and moderate income benefit, but we use that priority list. And same with drinking water, working with Department of Health. So there's a lot of coordination goes behind the scene, and we do try to concentrate on that priority list. So with that bit of information, I will let TCA explain the priority list.